My name is Candace. I'm 21 years old. I'll be 22 soon. I'm here because I'm not too impressed with the way the society has gone about doing things in my life and my daughter's life and to the people around me and people I don't know. So I'm hoping that in doing this, this is going to make a difference for myself and for the people out there that also need a difference.
What are some of the experiences that you had with the Children's Aid Society that you remember quite well? Let's talk about when you were in foster care yourself as a teenager growing up in the system. Let's talk about that first.
Okay. My biggest memories of the very first foster home I was in, I would have to say, is being locked in a basement. I remember coming out of a pretty, not horribly rough situation, but definitely traumatic at the time, and being put into a home which was allegedly supposed to be there to help me and benefit me and be definitely the best interest for me. And I remember being locked in a basement and wasn't allowed to make phone calls, couldn't talk to my worker, was unable to go to my room. There was bathroom times. I had to go to the bathroom at certain times. If I was on my menstrual cycle, I had to bring proof that I was to the worker, or not the worker, sorry, the foster mother. For example, used pads to get new pads, which was definitely hard for a 14-year-old. 14-year-old female, it's very difficult when doing things like that. Definitely not being able to leave my room. There was alarms on the stairs, couldn't leave the room. So it made you feel like a prisoner. Definitely not welcome or safe in any way. I felt a lot more safe at home than where I was.
And do you remember about what year that was?
I would have been just turned 14, actually. It was just after my birthday. My birthday is December 2nd, so I believe maybe 98, maybe? 90.
Approximately 7 years ago, then, eh?
About, yeah. I'm really bad with times and dates, but I assume around then, within that time period. And I remember being there over Christmas and being locked in the basement on Christmas. The basement was cold. It was very damp. It was plain white walls, nothing in there, just a TV, a bathroom, and a sofa. And it was just not very pleasant at all.
Were there any other kids in that facility with you?
Yes, there was, at the time, three other girls.
And where were they staying in the house?
It was a three-bedroom house. Sorry, there was three bedrooms and then the main bedroom. I remember the three bedrooms were side by side. The main bedroom was at the end of the hall. And the one bedroom was off limits, and I shared a room with another girl, and the other two girls shared a room together. So we were upstairs.
So when these times when you were locked in the basement, were these times when you, I guess, weren't in your room?
Yes. There were rules. You had to be out of your room by 7 a.m., weren't allowed back in your room until 9. So at that point, I'm assuming, was when the foster mother would turn on the alarms to the stairs between 9 and 7 a.m. When we left for school, we had to make sure that we gathered everything out of our rooms to be prepared for school. We weren't allowed to dress in our rooms. We had to grab what we needed, go downstairs to the basement, which was where we had to stay. We had to have our showers down there. We had to brush our teeth, get dressed. In this big room with nothing but a bathroom and three other girls other than myself trying to get ready for school within a certain time period. As a young teenager, you're always forever forgetting something. There were many times I forgot homework, clothes, things I needed to take to school that I was not allowed to go back up and get. I was unable, even though it wasn't such a big deal to run back up to the bedroom and simply open up the door and grab, homework off your desk or your makeup off your your dresser, you know, or socks out of your drawer. And that was just not acceptable.
Do you remember the name of the, were the foster parents, what were your thoughts of them as far as people?
It was a single woman. I remember her name clear as day. Many times in foster homes, it was that woman I could never get. It was the first place that I'd ever been in a foster home, and I've never forgotten her.
Well, what was her name then?
Rose Zettler.
Rose Zettler, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she was horrible. She was mean. She was cold. She was just... I remember coming home from school, and I've always been a happy, outgoing person. I've never really been shy. I've always been, you know, the laugh of the crowd, the person who's always, you know, doing things. And I would come home from school happy. Even in the bad situation I was in, I always kept my spirits high, and I would come in, and she would check my arms, and she would say, "You're too happy, or you're... What have you been doing? Are you on anything? Are you taking anything?" And I had no history of drug use ever. Not on any medication. I was just happy to, you know, happy kid. Just got off the bus with my friend, telling jokes on the bus, or, you know, doing everyday kid things. And I was just happy and outgoing. And I remember, you know, just her pulling up the sleeves of my shirt or my sweater, whatever I was wearing, and checking my arms like I was this criminal or some drug addict. And I was only 14, and I'd never had any history of this. There was no history whatsoever. And I just always felt so uncomfortable. I felt just the way she was with us, you know, having this day in the basement. No, "Hey, let's all watch a movie together," you know, something normal families do. Or, "Hey, let's all have dinner together, and, you know, we'll sit and we'll talk. How was your day? What did you do? Did you have fun?" Nothing. It was just come home, go down to the basement, check your arms, make sure you're not doing heroin at school in grade 9. And, it wasn't very comfortable at all. I wasn't happy.
Did you ever experience what you would consider any kind of physical abuse or emotional abuse outside of being locked in this basement? Did you yourself experience it, or did you witness any of the other girls?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what would be some of these things that you've witnessed?
Well, other than emotional abuse, I know that... The big thing for me was I did not like the tampon pad thing. As a female, that's a private thing. That's a very, you know, everybody knows it happens, but it's still one of those things that is your personal thing. It's your personal privacy. And you don't want to have to bring it up and have to show somebody this. I felt like my dignity was being taken away. I felt like my right as a woman was being violated, and that was some emotional things that happened to me. We were only allowed to take certain amount of pads to school. Some women are different. Some people need more. Some people need less. I remember being at school and being embarrassed in front of many people in grade 9, being 14 years old, because I didn't have pads, and, you know, I would have blood on my pants, and people would laugh at me and make fun of me, and I would be upset. I would cry about it. I would feel very emotionally hurt. Another time was the girl, I can't remember her name, but she was there. We were laughing down in the basement. We were, you know, trying to make the best of the situation that we were in, laughing, telling jokes, you know, just doing girl stuff, who'd you like it in high school kind of thing. And Rose had called her upstairs, and she had been up for a while, and it was almost dinner time, and I had gone up, and I had asked, you know, to see when dinner was, and Rose was angry, and the girl was crying, and I can't remember her name. I think it started with an M. I'm trying to remember. But I saw Rose hit her. This girl had a black eye. A couple days later at school, we were taking pictures at school, and we had taken a picture, and I still have the picture of this girl to this day, of her with the black eye taking pictures in the cafeteria. There was another girl there. Rosie was her name. Rose Bradbury, that was her name. I remember her name because she ended up in another foster home with me a year later, and that's how I remember her. And she had also been hit by her. And Rose had a bedwetting problem. Little Rosie had been sexually abused and had some serious psychological problems and wet the bed. Rose, big, like the foster mother Rose, would get upset with Rosie that she had wet the bed, and would get mad at her and push her around and hit her. I can't even continue to... There's so many things that I'd seen with that woman. She was just so cold and evil and cruel to these kids. From what I had heard, that her husband was the very, you know, the loving kind of person who wanted the kids. And when he passed away, I guess she continued on to be a foster parent, but never really enjoyed what she did. So she was, I don't know. We had ended up running away. All of us ran away. We didn't like it. I had told my workers several times that this woman was doing these things. I had told them that I didn't approve of having to present used sanitary pads to this woman, and there was nothing to be done. Nothing happened. After that, Rose stopped letting me call my worker. She wouldn't let me call my worker at all, I guess, afraid of what I'd say or what I'd do. And nothing got done, so I packed up my bags, and me and the other girls walked out, and that was the end.
How long were you in that group home?
Maybe,
or that foster home?
3 weeks, 4 weeks. It didn't take long for us to leave. The other girl that I had left with was in there maybe only a week or two before me, and it was us that said, we're not taking this anymore, and left. Nothing was being done.
Do you remember the name of the worker, the children's aid worker that was your...
Tina. No. Tina Riley? No. It was Tina. Something Tina.
Okay. Do you have any, like, papers that might...
I do. I have to find them.
You have to find them, okay.
I do. I definitely have lots of papers from when I was in myself.
Okay. So, from what you're saying, I get the impression that you try to tell the children's aid workers of the problems.
Absolutely.
That you felt that nobody was listening?
Absolutely. Like I said, I'm not one to hold back. I'm pretty outgoing. I say what's on my mind. I say how I feel. I've never been raised to... I've been raised to be a very independent woman, a strong woman, and I felt something was wrong, and I said something about it. And I felt nothing was being done, and I didn't like that, and I left. So...
And where did you end up after you were still 14 years of age? Right?
I was still 14. I turned my birthday is December 2nd. I went into foster care. I remember clearly a couple days after that. I spent Christmas over there over the holidays, so I was stuck there for a few weeks. Then we ran away not too long after that, and I remember us hitchhiking from... this was Keswick I was in, and I'm from Toronto. We hitchhiked from Keswick down to Toronto. There was two of us, two 14-year-old girls, hitchhiking because nobody would listen to us, and that was supposed to be safer than where we were. It was a lot safer than where we were, but nobody would listen, and we had to put our safety on the line just to get our voices heard. When we got to Toronto, I called the children's aid, didn't let them know where I was, and said, if you guys don't do something about this, I'm going to go to the newspapers. And I told them that I was going to call the newspapers, and I was going to tell everybody that they weren't listening to me. And sure enough, a week later, they had another home for me. So I went to that home, and that home was same place, actually, Keswick. It was on the other side of the town, though. And that place wasn't any better either.
So you're saying that home was a problem as well, eh?
Yeah. That one, it wasn't... there was much different aspects of this home. It wasn't so much as, like, there wasn't abuse, per se, as I saw Rosie being hit. I saw the other girl being hit. It wasn't to that extent. This home I was in, I didn't feel welcome. The kids there didn't welcome me, which happens. The foster father I remember always swore at me, always. If I did wrong, I would get... you know, sworn at, and I didn't like it. Like, I'm supposed to be here, everybody's telling me this is for my benefit, this is to help me, this is to make me, you know, do better, and this is more of a healthier environment than my mother's home. And my mother never swore at me. My mother didn't treat me like that. My mother never, ever gave me a black eye. My mother never locked me in a basement. My mother didn't allow me to only eat at certain times because I was an overweight girl, as I was considered in the second home. My mother never did any of that to me. And these foster homes I was in did this to me, and this was supposed to be more beneficial to me. I was in the second home. The foster father always swore. He was always swearing at me. The foster mother was a very large woman and would tell me that I could not eat at certain times because I was a bigger girl when I was younger. And that, you know, it would just make me overweight and I'd be hungry. I'd want to eat. And there was another girl there, I think it was their niece, who was staying there. She would have her boyfriend over all the time, and her boyfriend would make fun of me as a kid. And they were just mean, and they all went to the same school. They were all in high school. And they used to tease me in high school.
These would be the
people...
The foster parents' children?
The foster parent sister's children.
Okay.
It was her niece, I believe it was. And her boyfriend used to make fun of us at school for being foster kids. And everybody in the school knew that we were foster kids. Everybody knew. Friends of mine that I had wanted to go for sleepovers, which, not that I was allowed anyways, their parents always said no anyways because of the fact that I was a foster kid. The teachers would look down on us because we were foster kids. Everybody that I had known at that point in time would completely disregard me for anything I ever said. They would assume that everything I said would be a lie or illegitimate. Like, everything that I did, oh, you're a foster kid, you must, you know, have serious psychological problems, you must have something wrong, you must be bad, or you must be terrible. So there's this huge misconception of every time that anybody ever says, oh, you're a foster kid, everybody looks down on you. So they were quite happy to announce that we were foster kids to the entire school and made our life pretty much miserable. And, you know, when we would make it known to our foster parents that this was going on, oh, no, our family wouldn't do that. And it'll be in our family, so, you know, it's just nobody's being hurt. Nobody's doing anything about it, and people are getting away with it. And it just made me feel bad. It made me feel uncomfortable. I wasn't happy. And everything I did, the foster father would, you know, swear at me, you know, oh, you're this and you're that, and you didn't do that right, or you didn't do your chores good enough. Or I was never allowed to go out, never allowed to go to friends' houses, never allowed to do anything. I wasn't allowed to be a normal 14-year-old, you know, having sleepovers, throwing pillows, eating popcorn, and talking about the cute boy at school. That was just not acceptable. I missed out on that part of my life. And, you know, those are things that you don't get back. And these people took that away from me. And that was something that you just don't get back.
So. Now, at the second home you're at, again, did you try to report some of your complaints
always
to the workers again?
Always. Actually, at this point in time, I believe it was this point in time, I requested a different worker. I said that this worker wasn't listening to me, and I wanted a different worker. And I called this worker flat out, and I said, look, you're not doing what I want you to do. I want a different worker. And she said, well, you're going to have to talk to my manager. So I called the manager, the supervisor. And the supervisor said that I was just, you know, overreacting. And that how I felt was just, you know, due to who I am. I'm just, you know, some completely paranoid child with some horrible psychological problems. So I can't be true in anything I say. I want a new worker. I don't, you know, I didn't think she was good enough. I didn't think my needs were being met. I wasn't happy. And everybody just kept disregarding everything I said. I think I eventually did get another worker after a long point in time. But this was when I had had enough again. I told people I wasn't happy. At this point, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, you weren't happy in the last one and you're not happy in this one, so it just must be you. It must be your problem. It's something to do with you. It's not the foster homes. And I ran away again. And that was the end of that. And I went and I stayed with a girlfriend of mine in Keswick. She lived on a farm, so I made sure it was out of the way where nobody would find me. Eventually they did. The children's aid came out and set their home. This is off the wall, but I can't even remember. I'm trying to remember, but I remember something to do with the parents of this girl. Her name was Megan Rooney. I remember that. They were great people. And they gave me a room, my own room, and I was able to go to school, and things were great. And I remember the foster parents telling me that they requested blood tests and all sorts of other stuff, and I don't know if that's even legitimate, but something I always remembered, and I don't even know, but...
Eventually the children they decided knew that you were living at this
camp. I was there. They had found out through, I guess, the other foster homes kids that went to the same high school as me. I'm assuming that's how they found out. And they ended up leaving me there. I made it pretty clear that no matter what they did, I wasn't going back.
And you would be still 14 at that point?
I was 14. Actually, this I remember too. The foster father told the police that, mind my language, but he told the police that he told them to fucking bring me back, and that was it. And I remember the police telling me this, and the police said that they were concerned with how aggressive he was on the phone. And they told me that they weren't going to take me back there because the police were concerned of how aggressive he was.
And which, do you remember which police force that was?
Keswick is... I don't know what they would be considered.
Would it be the Ontario Provincial Police?
I'm assuming so.
Or there could be... Barrie is close by. Could it be the Barrie Police?
I don't remember.
I could probably find out. So.
But I remember them telling me that. And I remember them saying that they weren't going to... Because I said, if you take me back, then I'll be gone. I said, there's nothing you're going to do that's going to keep me there. And I remember them telling me that, how he had said it. And I remember somebody, I'm pretty sure that it was the foster home, that called the police when they had found out that I was, when the foster home had found out I was there, they had called the police and said that I was suicidal, to have the police come and take me back to the home. And they had called it so the police would come, and they did this to make the police come to my friend's house where I was staying, and have them take me out of that home and bring me back to the foster home, but it didn't work, because I refused to leave.
You're saying that false allegations were used by the foster parents to force you back?
To try and bring me back.
Okay. So what happened to you after that point, after the police didn't decide not to take you back anymore?
I stayed there, and I think the society was pretty much stuck between a rock and a hard place, because I was pretty stubborn as that I wasn't going anywhere. So I think they said that they're just going to leave me there. The worker called me, of course, weekly, and made sure that everything was good, and I ended up coming to a point at the end of the school year, and I had been talking to my mom lots, and I said, I'm leaving. And my mom just came and picked me up, and we went home, and that was the end of it. End of it all. And the society tried to come back into my life, and we just said, see you later, and kept moving around and just ignoring them every second we could. And
so you went back to live with your mother.
Yes.
And again, I'm assuming from what's going on that they took you out of your mother's care.
Yeah, my mom suffers from depression, so this was a big thing. And my mom had gone into the hospital, I remember. And somebody, I don't know who, called the children's aid, and they just kind of showed up. And I don't even remember where or how they showed up. I just have this vague memory of it. And I just remember going, and they tossed me into this home one night. And I was in there for a couple days, and then they put me in a foster home. So that was the first one they very first took me. So when I went back home with my mother, you know, my mom's a great person, and she suffers from, you know, a problem. And my mom's always been great. So I went back, and then, of course, I was a teenager, and I was, you know, didn't want to listen and never wanted to follow the rules. So I think this kind of pushed my mom a bit. And then my mom finally said, well, I'm calling the society. And if you don't want to listen to my rules, maybe you'll like listening to their rules. So my mom called the society. I think it was my mom. And they came. And it was supposed to just scare me. I think that was what my mom's intention was to scare me, because she knew I wasn't happy. She knew that it was a horrible experience for me. And I think she did it to try and get into shape, you know, like get yourself, get your act together, this is going to be what's going to happen. And they, of course, went overboard, as they usually do, and went from just being, you know, it was supposed to be just telling you that, you know, we'll take you back in if you don't listen to your parents kind of thing. And they took me in again. And
so they told you you had to come with them? So that the day that actually they had told you had to come with them, I mean, was it something where were there police there?
No, I don't even. It's really vague, but I remember when they took me in, it was supposed to be. I know it was like my mom's intention was just to scare me, to kind of make me stop being bad, and I remember just being there. It's kind of like this gap of my life, and I just remember being there again, and I remember they came up with these stories, these, like, my mother beating me with a broom, and my mother's, like, never hit me, ever, and there was just these horrible stories, and it's like the second time around, they were going to be sure to keep me, so, this time, they put me into this home, and the home was actually decent. It was a very good home. And I stayed there for about 2 years. And probably the only home out of my entire time and in my entire situation with the society that I've ever seen that was actually probably there for children.
Right.
So, and I mean, I've seen so many different foster homes. I had friends. I'd made so many. The only friends I could make when I was inside the society were society kids alone. Because they were the only people that would understand you, because anybody else would look at you and disregard you for being in the society itself.
Yeah.
So I met so many friends in the society and had met so many girls and so many people and know their stories in the society themselves. And just these horrible, like, horrible stories. I've seen horrible things. I've heard horrible things. And my friends have been through horrible things. So when I went there, I was almost like, you know, thank God, at least they're putting me somewhere at least remotely decent.
With the with all the kids that you've met through the Children's Aid that were, I guess you said most of them were Children's Aid.
Yeah.
Foster kids. Would you say that the majority of them, that the majority of their experiences were bad, or were they?
Oh, all of them. I don't think I met one person at all that was in the society that had anything good to say. I know girls that would talk to me. They would all come to me, and they would talk to me all the time, like the shoulder to cry on, and sometimes I felt like the only sane person at points, but there were these girls, and like normal girls that could do so much with their lives, and they're just like, they've been through horrible experiences that they can't change, and if these things have happened to them, and they can't change that, but they can make better for the future, and it's like the society is just holding them back from that. They're keeping them in that frame of mind, that point of time where, you know, this is all you can be, but it's not that way, and there's these girls that come out of these horrible situations, and they're put into horrible situations, and I've heard horror stories after horror story after horror stories. I've had friends cry their hearts out on my shoulders because they just want to leave. They can't take it. Boys, too. Like, I was in a both-sex foster home. This last one I was in had boys and girls in it. And I've seen just so much. The Christmas parties they would have, like, you know, see my old friends there that I'd seen pass in and out of different foster homes, and they're still jumping from foster home to foster home. I had girls dragged in group homes that were beaten in their rooms because if they didn't do something right in group homes, and group homes are tough. I know girls who would sleep in their group homes, and it was like jail. They would have bars on their windows and locks on their doors and nothing in their room. No different than jail, and all of these girls had was a problem that just needed somebody to talk to or needed help, and that wasn't help. That's making their problem worse. That's making them acknowledge that their problem is more than what it is. But it's not. They just need, you know, it's just, I'm not a psychologist, but I can tell you as their friend, all they needed was somebody there. They just needed somebody that wasn't continuing to hurt them that they had been hurt before.
I want you to maybe describe, you said that the first foster home you're in, you spent Christmas time there.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you describe maybe more in detail how was your Christmas there?
Horrible.
And how did you feel?
Horrible. It was terrible. I mean, Christmas is supposed to be that's the time every kid waits for in the year. It's Christmas. You know, Santa Claus is coming, whether you believe in him or not, and you're going to get all the greatest gifts, and you're hoping to get that new skateboard or that new Barbie doll, and, you know, that's just supposed to be that time. You know, I did see my family. I wasn't allowed to call my family. I spent my Christmas in a basement with three other girls and sat there with socks and, you know, these other, you know, it's not even the gifts, it's not about that, it was just how we felt. It was, you know, they had everybody upstairs having this great, you know, Christmas dinner, and we're all downstairs sitting there like about ready to start a fire because it's so cold in the basement and sing Kumbaya. It was just terrible.
So you're saying that actually while you were in the basement, three girls, the family was upstairs having a turkey dinner?
They were having a great time. They had all their family over, and we weren't allowed to associate with them. We weren't allowed to mingle with them. We were pretty much deprived of any Christmas spirit that there possibly could have been. There was no Christmas tree in the basement with lights, at least to, you know, give us this false hope of, like, a great, you know, a great Christmas or a new year coming. It was just this plain, you know, square basement with white walls, an old TV, this, you know, beaten up old couch, and that was it, and a door to a bathroom. Nothing in the bathroom, nothing else, just this monotone, empty, damp room, and it was just, here, take your book and your socks and whatever else you got and enjoy. You know, you can't really play throw the sock or something with a bunch of girls and enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Now, when you're in this basement, were there times when you were actually locked in the basement?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, there were times. We weren't allowed out of the basement. And when the time came to go to our room, it was 9 to 7. When the time came to go to our room, we had to leave from the basement directly to our room. We were not allowed anywhere else in the house. And it was on the dot every time. There was nothing else. I remember Dave even being sick and not being, you know, like, sick and not wanting to leave. And just, that's too bad. You're going to have to sleep in the basement. Well, the basement's cold and damp, and I'm sick, and I'm not going to go down into the basement. So, yeah, it was terrible.
So how did you know that you weren't supposed to allowed to call your friends? Did anybody actually tell you that you weren't allowed to call certain people or whatever?
Well, there'd be times where you'd say, can I use the phone and, you know, call so-and-so, or I'd like to call my mom, or I'd like to say Merry Christmas to my family, and they'd just tell you flat out, sorry, it's too bad, you know, can't make long-distance calls was one of the things I heard. Another one was, you're not allowed to associate with those people anymore. They're not allowed to know where you live was another, and if you called them and they had the phone number, then they could find you and all this stuff, and like this big conspiracy, like you're not allowed to have a life.
Did any of the children's aid workers actually tell you at any time that you were not allowed to speak to your family or contact?
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. The first worker I had, I was not allowed to call my mom. And it's not like, the first time around, there was no, you know, there's nothing, no stipulations on my mother. It wasn't like she was not allowed to see me or talk to me. My mom had even come up to the home. My mom flat out knew where I was. They had brought my mom to the home. So it's not like there was any fear of having my mother know where I was or any arguments with my mother. There was nothing at all. It was just flat out, no, sorry, can't go.
Did, while you were in the foster home, or when you first got involved, do you ever recall anyone mentioning to you about the child advocate's office? Were you ever given any?
I don't even heard of that.
Okay.
So, no.
Did anyone ever give you any information that explained to you what your rights were?
Never. Never once. No. I still have, to this day, amongst my papers that I've collected over the years, the society little pamphlets that you can pick up in the office, and they all say, you know, we protect children's rights and all this, and I was never given a right for anything. I always thought it was a little contradictory, and every time I saw it.
Looking at the, you know, now that you're older and have had a number of years to experience and seen a lot of things, looking back at the situation you're in with your mother, before you're 14, how would you compare as the experience you had, say, with your mother as compared to the Children's Aid Society? Do you think it was better, or do you think better in the care of the Children's Aid Society, or do you think, in a sense, it was worse than being with your mother?
It was worse by all means than being with my mother. The time with my mother, I mean, I have the greatest memories. I have, my mother did a good job at raising me. It just, when I look back and I think about it, it was all child rebellion. It was all being a teenager, doing the bad things you do, learning from your mistakes, and just, everybody has it. Everybody has the teenage rebellion, you know. My mom, my father wasn't around in my life, so I had issues with that. My mom had her boyfriend, and, you know, so I was rebellious. I was against it all, and my mom was just trying to do the best she could. And I have a lot of respect for my mother for being able to deal with me for all that. My mother was a great mother. She taught me a lot. I mean, in grade one, I had a grade four reading level. My mother read to me every day. My mother always made me feel like I had a home, you know, that I had a good place to live. My mother never beat me. My mother never swore at me. My mother never treated me like anything less than an equal. My mother was always there. And when I was in the society, I felt so criminal. I felt horrible. I felt like I had no rights. I felt like I had nothing. And every last bit of what I had that I had fought them with just to make it through those years was everything that my mother had taught me. And I would by no means ever suggest anybody ever put their kid in the society by any means, because I think, in my opinion and my personal experience, that there was no place other than home that was ever better for me.
And how do you get along with your mother today?
We have the greatest relationship. Me and my mom are pretty much like two peas in a pod. I can tell her everything and anything. My mom calls me, you know, all the time. Hey, how's it going? My mom's completely open with me with everything. She's my mother. She's my best friend. She's, you know, my girlfriend. She's just the greatest, and I'm glad to have her.
Do you think, in your opinion, based again on what you see now, because I guess this all started, what, when you were 14, or
about that,
or was what, when you were 13?
Around that age, it was okay. Within that period.
So, I mean, you certainly are older now and have had a chance to think about all these things now.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that the Children's Aid Society may have overreacted?
By all means, completely. I don't even think it's overreaction. I think it's downright ignorance. They put words into my mouth when I look back at the court papers that I have, even now, today. Everything that's ever been said, it's like putting words into your mouth. If you say, if I said I took a shower, you know, with my mother when I was five, they turn around and say, oh, well, your mother sexually abused you in a shower. It's like completely, they take every little thing you say and turn it around. I mean, I think I told them that I got into an argument with my mother, and they turned around and said that my mother was beating me. My mother's never beaten me.
And you still have those court papers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have all of them. Yeah.
Okay. Knowing that the Children's Aid Society obviously has some money, mm-hmm. to use, and they have resources, do you think that there may have been other ways that, knowing that the Children's Aid Society again has money and maybe has some services, do you think that there may have been other ways that the Children's Aid Society may have assisted your mother without having to take you away and put you in foster
home? My mother's home was very clean. She had a good home. The only thing was that we needed was maybe family counseling to get aside from our issues. There was no need for apprehension. There was no need for anything at all. It's not like my mother was without. It's not like I was without. My mother was always providing. My mother had a good job that she had for 10 some odd years. You know, we weren't middle class, but we weren't lower class either. We lived a very comfortable life. We weren't worried about where the next food, you know, bit of food was coming from. Everything was good. If anything, if they were so concerned, in my opinion, they should have maybe had a mediator come in, you know, talk to us, you know, set aside our issues at the time of being, you know, just a rebellious teenager and a mother trying to cope with a rebellious teenager, because there's what, 9 out of 10 mothers that are going through that every day with their teenagers. It's not like it was something out of the ordinary or something uncommon. It was everyday, average, you know, occurrences that happen to every family, every person that's got a teenager, you know, and there was just no need for it. That's like saying, you know, that's kind of calling the kettle black. You can't do that. You can't say, well, if this one family's got the exact same thing that's going on, but we're going to go and apprehend this other person's family, you know, or a child. If anything, I think that they should have just, if it was so much of a concern to them, they should have had a mediator to come in and set aside our differences and put us on the right track to a healthy relationship, which we have now. And that's all. That's all that needed to be done. And instead, they took a small issue and made it into a huge issue and made a lot more problems for my life and made it a lot harder for me to grow. So,
do you think at this point in life that you'd say that you've suffered as a result of
this? Absolutely. I now suffer from an anxiety disorder. I worry about everything. I can't help myself but to worry. I worry of every little thing, you know, and I put a lot of that blame on worrying about, you know, where I was going to live, jumping from place to place and having to run away and having all these different types of people in my life that I had never had in my life before. There were times when I myself thought I was going to suffer from depression and have suffered, just from seeing so much, and it's hard to intake at such a young age, you know, seeing things yourself, having things happening to yourself, and having people around you have these things happen, and you just knowing about it and knowing it's wrong and not liking what you see and feeling that you can't do anything about it. Just this feeling of complete in control, like no control of what you can do and no control of your life. And now it's just this worry. Like, now I worry every day about, you know, just little things. Like, I find myself worrying about the littlest things that I can sit there and tell myself that I know, you know, I'm intelligent enough person to know that I shouldn't even worry about them because it's the most insignificant thing ever, but I worry about it. It's just this problem that I can't get over. I worry just too much.
So at this point, I mean, this all occurred, I guess, about 7 years ago, and you've offered to speak to me about these situations. And what is motivating you at this point in time now to want to bring forth your stories about with the Children's Aid Society?
Well, I've always said that I was able to put what had happened to me. I believe that a lot of things that happened to me made me a stronger person. It's put me on the path I am today. It's made me want to do better, to never have something like that happen again to me. I suffer from it, yes. I have bad memories, yes. But I continue to move on with my life. It wasn't till they came into my daughter's life that was the end of it. That was the last straw of them interfering with my life. It was one thing to interfere with my own life that I was in control of. It was another thing for them to interfere with my daughter's life where my daughter can't fight back.
So the Children's Aid Society came into your life again when you had your first child.
My daughter, yes.
And which year was that now?
My daughter was born in 2003.
Okay. Now, do you think that your prior involvement with the Children's Aid Society somehow targeted you?
Absolutely. They came completely out and said that was part of the reason. They pretty much said that you are obviously still a child. You cannot, you know, they gave me no credit for being an adult, no credit for doing anything in my life. It was pretty much, well, you have a history, so it's like saying that you can't be any better, that that's who you're going to be forever, and that's the end of it. You know, this is who you are in our eyes, and no matter what you do with your life, that's always going to be it. So we're going to, you know, come back in, and we're going to cause some problems for you.
So again, I was trying to find out what's motivating you right now to want to tell your story and to get your story out to the public about what's happened to you. What is it you would like your information, your experience to do for others or whatever?
I want to stop. Obviously, I want to stop the injustices that are being done to people. People have problems. Everybody has problems. And people don't deserve, or they should not ever have to go through the things I've gone through and there's worse, there's much worse. I consider myself fortunate of what I've had happen to me in this society, because I know way more that's happened to more people, and I don't think I could be as strong of a person as I am today if those things had happened to me. And I want to stop what's happening to these people. I want to stop the continuing abuse from the society to those people. That's also probably going to happen to those people's children. I want the world to know what's going on. I want anybody who's watching anything that comes out of this to see and know. I don't think that this should carry on. I don't think anybody should be funding these people. If they are, I think somebody needs to police it. Somebody needs to be there watching it. Somebody needs to be in control, because it's completely out of control. There's no rules, there's no laws, there's no nothing. When you're in the society, you go by what they say, and nothing is ever by the book, ever. And it needs to be by the book. Something needs to change. It's got to stop, because our children are the future. We were supposed to be the future then. And now there's so many of us that have been there that have not come out, you know, on top, and that now suffer for the rest of their lives, and maybe never will be able to come out of the hole that they've been pretty much put into and make it somewhere.
Now, you had said at one point about the Children's Aid Society that they twist things, or would you go so far as to say that in your experience that they had actually fabricated things that weren't true?
Oh, yeah.
About you or your mother?
Yes. I remember the big one that I have on paper was that me and my mother had gotten into an argument, and that was when she pretty much said, well, if you don't want to listen to me, well, then maybe this society can fix you, to kind of scare me into being good. And I remember them turning around saying that my mother beat me with a broom. And I don't ever remember saying anything even about a broom. There is nothing to do with a broom. It kind of just, I was like, wow, where did this come from?
Yeah. And let me ask you a question. Do you feel that it might protect children better and protect parents better if Children's Aid workers were required to either audio tape or videotape their interviews with you when they're collecting information?
Yeah. I'd even go as far as to say that there should be a neutral third party there to make sure that everything's good. Because I find some of the times, even if you're being videotaped, that I find that they bully and they say things and they kind of twist things. And it's kind of like asking the same question twice but not saying the exact same thing. But it, you know, pretty much leads to the same question, how they twist it. And sometimes they just say things and you're saying how you feel, but they twist it around anyways. And you're not sure how to answer them or how to go about answering them, and I definitely find that it feels like they're bullying you. And I'd even go as far to say, as a third party to sit there who's completely neutral in the matter, on videotape itself or audio tape, you know, to catch that.
Yeah. Do you think, though, again, that if there was a videotape, that there might be less?
Absolutely. There definitely would be less. They, a lot of the times they threaten. They've threatened me several times. And I think that's a big thing, because I don't think that's right. And I think that would probably stop making families feel so vulnerable to them if they had to be videotaped. Maybe make families feel a little more comfortable with their own rights and what they can do, and maybe help the situation a little more, because then maybe the society won't feel so apt to go and start threatening people and causing problems in people's lives.
I'd like to talk a little bit about any involvement or knowledge or whatever you had about drugs or medication while you're in the group home. Did they try to medicate you or give you medication or force on medication?
Yes. I was in high school. I was above average student. All my grades were extremely high. My grades were, I was on the honor roll. I had the first year, I think it was an 87 average. The second year, I had a 94% average, and then so on and so on. And so I was doing good in school. I was always, you know, did my work, did what I had to do, did well in school. They had me see a psychologist, and of course, a Children's Aid appointed a psychologist. Wasn't just any psychologist, you know, off the street kind of thing. Always everything that ever happened was always a Children's Aid appointed, you know, physician or psychologist. I mean, we would travel down to Toronto for these appointments. I couldn't just go to any regular doctor that I had had before. I couldn't even see my old doctor, my family doctor. They had a psychological assessment done, which I have that as well. Said that that I was extremely hostile, which I've never been extremely hostile. As a person, I'm not hostile. Towards the person, yeah, that's sitting there saying that I'm hostile, yeah, I was pretty not impressed with it. Another thing they said, though, was that my intelligence level was below average. And here's something where I had trained professionals in the high school telling me every year with every class I took that I was obviously very intelligent enough to be able to take enriched advanced courses at my level and still come out with, you know, 85 plus on all of my courses, telling me that I was below average and completely made me feel like I was insignificant to everything I had accomplished so far. They started taking me to therapy saying that I was depressed all the time and that these little things I would do meant that I was depressed. And which, yes, there was points in my life where I've, you know, had depression, but I don't know anybody who would have gone through what I've gone through without having points where, you know, you just need to take a break from reality and just relax and, you know, just have a hot bath or get away from things for a little while.
Just to interrupt there, I mean, when they talk about depression, would some of these things that maybe you're causing your depression been caused by the fact that you were in the Children's Aid Society?
Yeah, for sure. You know, the fact that I couldn't call my mom, you know, on Mother's Day or something, you know, yeah, that would make me feel terrible. And then I'd feel horrible. And, you know, on a day that I would never cry on, you know, I'd be sitting in my room crying and being upset. And everybody's, why are you crying? Oh, there must be a reason for it. Oh, you must be depressed or there must be something wrong with you. No, I'm sorry. Well, you just denied me from calling my mother or, you know, I've had a bad day at school. I just want to say hey to my mom, you know, because my mom's my best friend and she's going to make my day bright. Or, you know, I want to go out and I want to be like the rest of the girls and I want to go to the sleepover and watch movies and, you know, do all the things that other people my age are doing. And when I'm being denied that, yeah, I'm not that great. So there was definitely times where a lot of it was put on and brought on by the society.
Now, when they took you down to the CAS Society psychologist, do you feel that, again, that all this information was being twisted around to suit what they wanted?
Absolutely. I can't remember the name of the test, but they're called the INFLOTS. They have a name. They were showing me those, and I mean, they would show you flat out things, like they start off with ink blots, and you could tell flat out that one looked like a ladybug or something, and of course they're looking to see what your response is, if it's going to be, and I went in there and I completely knew what was going on, and you know, I felt like I was, my intelligence was being, you know, disregarded completely, so of course I can see why they said that I had, you know, that I was hostile, because they showed it to me, and I said it looked like an ink blot. And so I wasn't impressed at all. You know, they're telling me that they're going to take me to some psychological thing, so of course I'm going to be rebellious, and I did what I did, and I felt completely, you know, like they were insulting my intelligence by all means. And they showed me this one picture of a woman laying at the foot of a bed, and I remember this clearly, and the man was standing at the door of the picture. And she was crying. She had her hand, and his hand was up in a motion as if he was going to hit her. And by all means, anybody that looks at that is going to see that picture and going to know that that's what that picture is. But you know, if you tell them that, they're going to turn around and say, oh, well, you know, even though it's flat out, you can see that the picture, you know, nobody's going to say, yeah, they're eating an ice cream and enjoying their day. You can tell flat out that that's what they're fishing for, and I wasn't stupid, and I knew exactly that that's what they were going for. So I said, well, it's her birthday, and she was crying, and, you know, made this huge story up, you know, made it look completely not even to what it was, you know, and I just played their game back and hope they enjoyed the fun. And
So you thought that trip to their psychologist
was an
insult to your intelligence?
I completely. And then they turned around and told me that my intelligence was below average, and here's, you know, trained professional educators who educate people every day. That's like saying, well, if all of these different teachers in the school are telling me that my intelligence is obviously above average, that I'm capable of handling the workload at an advanced level, that I'm capable of doing this. And then I'm walking into a children's aid approved psychologist who's working at the society headquarters and is telling me that my intelligence is above level, then, or below intelligence level, then that must either say either there's something wrong there and there's something going on, or then we need to all worry about our children going to school, because obviously all of those teachers don't know what they're doing and everybody's just not even up to par with intelligence at all. So I was definitely insulted, and I wasn't surprised at all when they put in the report that I remember it clearly. I have the papers where they said that I was hostile, and hostile probably because the psychologist wasn't impressed with my fighting back to the whole fight the power of the children's aid.
Now, do you think that there was any other motive for them wanting to take you down to their psychologist?
Yeah, they were always trying to go up. Like, I mean, they used everything. They said my father not being in my life, that I was psychologically, yeah, I had problems. Yeah, I was hurt with the fact that my dad wasn't in my life, but that wasn't, I didn't dwell on it. You know, I never once dwelled on it. I never once thought about it on a daily basis. You know, there was points in my life where high school or, you know, public school graduation, grade graduation, you know, that, yeah, I'd love my dad to be there and see something like that. But they dwelled on it. They dwelled on it more than I did. They, you know, there was things that they would just dwell on. Oh, your mother, you know, is depressed. And yeah, my mom's depressed, but you know what? I never saw it throughout my life. I never knew. I never knew till I was 14 that my mom suffered from depression. Never. My life was never, you know, open to that. My life was never, you know, nobody ever let it known to me. My mom didn't seem like anybody who was depressed. You know, I always remember my mom as this happy person growing up, and we did things, you know, we would draw. My mom is an amazing artist, and, you know, I picked up things from her when I was growing up with, like, painting. You know, me and my mom used to oil paint when I was, like, 12, and my mom read to me every day, and I love books. Like, I always had this huge above-average reading level, and I always educated myself through reading. I still, to this day, read, you know, fiction and non-fictional books, and I get so much, you know, so much information, and I just get so much from it now. And I thank that for my mother. My mother did that, and I never saw that. So they were dwelling on these things that I didn't even know existed. And it was, you're this, you've got that. They had tried to have me tested for ADHD, which I think was one of the basis of why they took me to see a psychologist, trying to say I was below average intelligence, maybe that I had problems concentrating, to try and put any kind of blame that they could on me. And then maybe the next thing was I was suicidal, so you're going to have to see a therapist. They sent me to the therapist. I had to see the therapist. I had to miss a day of school every week and go see the therapist, which I wasn't impressed with at all. And they would talk about things that I was just, whatever, you know, okay, let's talk. And they would just go on these stories, and I'd be like, what are you talking about? You know, what is this? Where do you get this stuff from? If we're going to talk, let's talk. You know, ask me how I feel. You know, ask me what I think's going on. Don't just start spouting off these children's aid, you know, stories and expect me to know what you're talking about, because I don't.
So, again, these therapists that he went to, would you, again, consider them to be insulting your intelligence?
Oh, absolutely.
Or even at 14 years of age, you...
Yeah, I was pretty insulted. Yeah.
Okay. Would you consider these trips to the therapist and to the psychologist really a complete waste of time?
Oh, absolutely. I enjoyed school. I had fun in school, and there would be days where it's just be like, most kids would be, yeah, a day away from school. I'd be like, send me back to school. I don't even want to be here. I'd rather be sitting in class with my friends or, you know, seeing what's going on in biology class or hanging out after school than doing this. This is not what I want to be doing.
Now, at any time, did the children's aid, did they try to put you on any kind of medication?
They talked about it, and they talked, and I just told them flat out. I said, it doesn't matter what you give me, you'll have to fight me to put it down my throat. You won't give me anything. There were times where I remember trazodone, or I think it was called trazodone, because the girl, I remember the name because the girl Holly in my room, she was on it also, and she, I mean, they put her on everything. Same with Rosie. I, like the girl I told you about earlier, Rose Bradbury, she ended up in the second time around I was in a foster home. She ended up with me again in this foster home. They had her on everything. And all of these girls, everybody in there was on medication, except for me and the boy there, which me and the boy Johnny, I consider him like my brother, you know. We were two peas in a pod, and we were just like, we can't stand being here. And he was much younger than me. He was a younger boy. But, you know, he refused to. He was just quite the power and refused to take it. So we were the only two people in the house that refused to take anything. And I remember the name trazodone, I don't even know if I'm saying it right, because the girl, Holly, in my room was also on it. And they were trying to put it to me, and she had, I mean, they put her on everything. They said she was, I remember when she first came in, she was a very bright young lady, very bright, when she first came in. They put her on these medications, and all of a sudden it's like, here, you're going to take medication for ADHD. And then all of a sudden she stops paying attention to everything. It's like, it's almost like by saying that they're going to put her on it, it's almost like that's what she assumes. And that's, you know, it's kind of like saying, oh, well, they're putting me on it, I must have that problem. And then all of a sudden you start feeling like you have the problem, and it's like a whole psychological thing all on its own. It's just...
So in from what you've seen, this one girl, would you say that you've seen this girl come in, and after going on medication, she appeared to be worse off?
Oh, yeah. Because it seemed when she first came in, she was very quiet, which a lot of them are. Some are, some aren't. But she was very quiet. She was, you know, very, well, she was very good. And then they put her on medication, and then I guess things just got really rough for her. And she started being bad. She became worse than from when I know her. I remember the first few months, she was great. We were friends. We hung out. And then she got bad. She started hanging around the wrong people. She started doing drugs. And it was like this escape. And that's all it is. There's no difference between drugs and taking Ritalin, you know. What's the difference between taking ecstasy and making yourself happy to taking another drug? It's all doing the same thing. It's all medicating you to hide something inside when what's the point, you know?
Yeah. So now, you said that she kind of succumbed to some bad influences. Now, would these be other kids that they're associated with the Children's Aid Society, or?
I think these were kids in general. I can't even remember her group or her crowd. But it got to a point where she was always angry. Always. I mean, we started fighting all the time, and at the end of it, we got into a fight, and she left, and she just wasn't the same. You know, she started saying all sorts of stuff, and she was into drugs all the time, and not like heavy, heavy drugs. It wasn't like she was, you know, smoking crack or something terrible. You know, she was just trying to escape. She was, and you could tell, because it just wasn't Holly anymore. Holly that I knew was fun, and we would have a great time, and she was great, and then she just deteriorated into this hateful, angry, I'm going to go out and get high, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to run away because that's a cool thing to do, and I'm going to get away from this hole. And it was always, I hate it here. And, you know, it was just this horrible person had come out of her. And it's almost like she changed. I watched her change in a year. It was just, and then she left, and God knows where she is now. But, yeah, I definitely have seen people change for the worse.
Now, would you say in her case that her experience in the Children's Aid Society would have made her want to escape, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did she express, like, the same kind of concerns you were having, like, not happy with the care there? And
we would talk about it every day, and, like, the girls would sneak into each other's rooms, and we would sit there and be girls, since we weren't allowed to do that anywhere else, you know? We weren't allowed to have that normal teenage thing, you know? We would have to disobey the rules to just have some, you know, sense of normality in our lives. And we would sneak into each other's rooms and do the girl thing and, you know, do makeup at, like, midnight when all the lights are off and talk about what we hated. And we would sit there. And this is kind of a funny story, but Johnny, which was my brother, my foster brother, we used to have a little radio. And we had all pitched in and bought it from Radio Shack. And we told our foster parents that Johnny's dad bought it for him. But we had all pitched in and put all of our money together that we had saved up for allowances. And it was one of those old, you know, those, like, CB cop radios where you could hear people. We used to sit there in the basement And every time we knew that our foster mother was talking to the children's aid, we would turn it on and we would listen to the conversations and we would know exactly what was going on. And me and Johnny, we were terrible because, like I said, we were two peas in a pod. We would get away with everything. And we weren't, you know, we were, like, if we put, me and him put our minds together, we'd get away with everything. I mean, I was, like, 16 at the time and he was, like, 14. So he was younger than me, but we used to, like, we used to go and do the craziest things, and we'd hit up Radio Shack, and we'd get tapes, and we'd record it all, and we'd do all sorts of stuff. And we'd know, and we'd hear these horrible things told by us, and we'd be like, this is not even true. And we used to laugh about it late at night.
So you're actually saying that you were able to, you kids were smart enough to intercept some of the phone?
Yeah, we used to do it all the time. It was a cop TV. I don't even know if they sell them anymore. But when we lived in Barrie, there's a Radio Shack down the way from us. And me and Johnny, we were always together. They used to accuse us of, we were great friends. He was like, I consider this boy, I would love to see him today. He's like my brother. You know what I mean? We had been through so much together at that time when we needed each other. And he's like, he was just like the little brother, you know, my little brother. And it was like, so we were always together. They used to say, oh, well, we must be doing something together. And it was never like that. You know, he was younger than me. I was like, ew, gross. But we were, you know, we were best friends. We were best friends. He was my brother. He was like the brother, you know, that I needed at the time, you know, that little piece of family to try and make where I was a home. And we used to go out and we would do the crazy. His dad would give him money every time he visited his dad every 2 weeks. His dad would give him money, and my mom would give me money, and we'd put it together, and we'd just do everything. We'd go out, and we'd buy these radios, and we'd buy, like, the little CDs, and we would, yeah, every time that we knew, because the foster mother would go in her separate room, and she'd sit there for, like, 2 hours talking on the phone with these workers. So we'd just go downstairs in the basement, and we'd hide in the room, and we'd turn it on, and we'd listen to every little thing that went on. And it's easy because the radios, you have, like, a frequency, and you can do it, like, a distance frequency in that. And we used to catch her all the time. We used to listen to all of the conversations she had. And then late at night when we were bored and, you know, we didn't want to go to bed and everybody else was asleep and we weren't allowed to go and do anything, we used to just sit in the room and catch other people's phone calls and just laugh and, you know, have fun. But, yeah, we used to listen to everything that went on. We knew always. So we were always prepared. Every time we knew that our workers were coming and the children's aid was going to talk to our foster parents and that we had a meeting coming, every time that she would get on the phone, we'd use the CB radio and we would catch what they were saying. So when they came, we were always prepared with what they were going to come and bring. And they never, me and Johnny always had, like, we were always one step ahead of them. They could never, ever, you know, I never had a problem the second time around because I don't think they had any chance to start a problem.
Yeah.
So
when you did intercept these conversations between the worker and the foster care parent, did you find that, again, that there seems to be there's something for fabricated to make
you... everything. We would sit there and be like, this is not even true. They used to accuse Johnny of stealing all the time because we always had money. So, and because we were always together, it's almost like they were trying to break us apart, me and Johnny. Me and Johnny were very close. They would say everything from, I wonder if they're... I mean, I was 16 and he was 14, and they one time came out and asked us if we were having sex, which is completely, like, never even came about, you know, something that never he'd even crossed our minds that we had thought they would ever accuse us of. Another one was that we were stealing. They thought we were stealing money from the foster parents because we always had money. My mother would give me money every time I went to go visit her, you know, here, you know, have lunch at school kind of thing or get yourself a new outfit, whatever you needed, right? Same with Johnny's father. Johnny's father would do the same thing. And we used to just do it for fun. We used to spend it on fun things, and we'd go out and buy CDs, or another big thing is we used to play video games together. So me and Johnny would, his dad bought him a PlayStation when it first came out for Christmas or something. So me and Johnny would go to the used shops, and we'd put together our money, and if we each had $10, we'd buy a $20 used game, and we'd sit there and play video games together. And, you know, so they were always trying to break us apart. Like, it always seemed that way. So they're always coming up with these bogus, you know, stories of whatever. And so, yeah, we would sit there and we would laugh at these things and we'd hear them talk about us. Oh, Johnny's with Candace all the time and there's something going on. And I don't know, they talk in, Johnny's from Thailand and Johnny would teach me Thai. and we'd sit there and we'd speak and die in front of them, and we'd talk about them. And we heard this one time on the phone that they were talking about how this one crate, I think they're starting a plant. It was that we were stealing. They thought we were stealing. So we heard over the phone that she was telling the worker that they think that we were planning our way to steal, speaking in a different language and all this other stuff. We were just being kids. We were being, you know, rebellious kids. We were being bad. We were just doing what kids do. And we'd sit there right at the dinner table and speak in Thai, and then I'd say something and he'd laugh and everybody'd be looking at us. And then I'd say something and he'd just look at me and he'd laugh. So, you know, we were kind of like our own little army. We fought the best way we knew how, and we did it together, and we stuck together, and that's what we did, and we made it through together. So, you know, it's almost like just because of the fact that he was a boy, they kind of made a big deal about it. If it was a girl, it made me not even, I don't know, if it was a girl too, they probably accused me of something also. But to them, it was unhealthy. You know, to them, that wasn't appropriate. It wasn't appropriate for me and him to be so close. And, you know, I have a younger brother who's younger than him, and I have the same relationship with my younger brother. It's no different. He was just, you know, another brother to me. He was like, he was the piece of family I needed there. He was that bit of home that I had missed out on. And we just, you know, he was like my other half. He was my partner in crime.
And basically they wanted to break you up then.
All the time. They even accused Rosie, the girl that had been in a foster home before. She was seriously sexually abused as a child. Her mother used to let random people, and this was a girl that deserved to be, like, that needed to be out of her home. One of the very few, I should add, that actually shouldn't have been in her home. But she had been through the most horrendous things you could possibly think of, and they put her in these horrible situations. And it's like, that's not making this girl any better. This is making her worse. She accused Johnny of touching her because me and Johnny, like I said, we used to speak in Thai to each other. And Rosie used to think that we were talking about her. So she never liked Johnny. She always hated Johnny because at first she used to have a crush on Johnny, and then Johnny was just like, girls, whatever, because he was young. He was the young boy that was like, girls are gross kind of thing. So he never paid any mind to her, and she was young too, but she had that mind frame, you know, that state of mind. She was, you know, she had been through that, so that's kind of all she knew. And she had accused Johnny of trying to have sex with her or something. Or no, it was the foster mother assumed that they were having sex. Something a lot, I can't even remember how it all went down the line, but I remember them just like trying to rip us apart. They just always wanted to rip us apart.
So you're saying that this girl Rosie accused the...
Yeah, Johnny of I remember they called the police too or something. I can't even remember how it went. There was just some big deal, and Johnny, he told me, he's like, Candace, he's like, you know me better than anybody else. He's like, I never did it. I said, I know you didn't do it.
So what happened to him at that
time? I can't remember what happened. I think at this point I had run away from there. And then Johnny, after I left, Johnny went down a big path. Like, he just kind of went down. He had nothing left there. After I left Johnny, there was just nothing left for Johnny there. No one to talk to. He kind of had nothing. And he started running away to his dad's house. And then it was just this big war between our foster parents and his dad. And then the last thing I heard, the foster mother kicked him out and said, that's it, I don't want you here anymore. And he went to live with his dad, and I haven't heard the same from him.
Yeah.
I mean, they said everything. Like I said, with the thing with us having sex, I mean, like, we were kids. We were like, what are you talking about? It's something that never even came into our minds, or we ever even thought about, or came, you know. So it was just, they would go to these extents to, you know, just these extents to kind of like, I don't know, debunk us, destroy us.
So they'd make things worse than what they really were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing, it's not like there was any signs that anything like that, it would just come out of nowhere, you know what I mean? Like,
okay, what we can probably do then is to move on to your more recent, experience with your your daughter is what, 2 years?
Yeah, my daughter's two.
Two, yeah. Okay, so tell you what, let me just give you an open question just to say, okay, so the children's aid kind of got out of your life for, what, a few years? Cause
I left and I moved out on my own and I was working and going to school and doing a little bit of things here and there, and
then what happened? So you were kind of out of everything. Nobody was bugging you for what? 2 or 3 years?
Yeah,
4 years?
Yeah, I did. I left when I was 16. Started living on my own when I was 16. And probably wasn't until I was 19. So yeah, about 3 years.
3 years. Did you ever, was there any involvement at all with the children's aid?
Nothing.
Did they ever at any time offer you to have their, they have a program, I think, where they have up until about your 20 where they'll pay you more than welfare will.
To live on your own. There was something about that, but they never ever gave it to me. I had to live in their, the only thing that I was offered was I had to live in, it was kind of like a, it was their home, like it was a CAS stationed home, and I rented a room out of their home, and I had to do their chores around the house and eat, you know, in their kitchen. It wasn't no different than just living in a group home. It was pretty much the same thing, except I had to pay for it.
Oh, I see.
So that was just not, no, I didn't want anything really related to that. I wanted my own thing. I wanted to.
So you went out and started doing your own thing, and you left it alone. So
yeah.
when did the involvement, describe to me how the involvement of the Children's Aid Society came back in. Maybe you could give me a little bit of background. You know, obviously you were away till 19 and you got pregnant.
Yeah.
Met a boy, I guess.
I met my daughter's father, Tyson, and we were, I'm a big addict of video games, thanks to Johnny, so me and Johnny had built that video game addiction. So I had gone to, I looked in the newspaper and there was a video game ad thing that I went, and sure enough, that was Tyson, and we had met, and we had started hanging out, we started dating. And then soon after, I got him pregnant, and we decided to keep the baby, because it's not like we were bringing it into some horrible environment. You know, we had a business, we had a home, we were able to provide, so we decided, why not? Let's go for it. So we had, you know, set everything up, started buying what we needed, did our thing, moved the business out of the home, opened up a storefront for the business. And we ended up getting into this really big fight one day, and the police were called, and Tyson was taken away and arrested, and which, of course, that was completely blown out of proportion, and that was that. Nothing else happened after that. You know, I moved out. I lived on my own. We still talked. We still did what we needed for the baby. We both went to prenatal classes. We both did parenting. Still went together and did those things, even though I lived on my own and he lived where he lived. We still, you know, tried to do the best and make the best of the situation and do what we could for our child. And
but during this time, there had been charges.
Yeah.
Did he go to court? Was he found guilty?
Yeah, I called. Well, the things that had come back from that what the police had said were just completely, you know, it was like, that's not what happened. So I had contacted the police and said, look, you guys really made this overboard. And yeah, we were in a fight, but like, you guys turned around and called it like everything else in the book. And that's not what happened. You know, it wasn't as to the extent that you guys were putting it at. You know, that didn't happen. And this didn't happen. And yeah, we fought, but everybody fights. And somebody just happened to call the police about it kind of thing. So, I called and, you know, to have, you know, to try and have these charges removed. We didn't want any problems from us having a baby. You know, we didn't want any repercussions. We wanted to move on with our lives. I didn't feel he was a threat. I wasn't threatened by him. I moved out on my own so we wouldn't fight, and the relationship between us, yes, was over. But as a father, I'm not threatened by him. You know, I don't have any fears of what he's going to do to my baby or anything like that. So time went on, nothing happened, you know, we just went on with our lives, the courts were going to throw it out, you know, it was just going to be let out of court with, you know, something minor, like, I don't know what happened with it. I applied for maternity, and you usually do that about a month and a half or 2 months before you're actually going to give birth, and about 2 weeks before I had my daughter, Children's Aid called my home, and I was just like, you know, kind of shocked that they called me and said that they wanted to come in, and I asked them what their reasons were, and they said that about the police had called them about 6 months before, saying that we had been in a fight. And I said, well, and they said that they had child protection concerns. I said, well, if you had child protection concerns, and this happened 6 months ago, are you not concerned at the fact of my unborn child, if you were so concerned? You know, here's an unborn child, and you're saying that you think the father's a threat, and that you think there's this huge threat, yet you're concerned only now that my daughter's going to be born. What if he was actually dangerous? He could have, you know, beat me up, and I could have lost my daughter, period, if there was such a concern. Yet they had absolutely no concern, but now they did. So they came into my life, and they did an assessment of my home, and they walked out, and they said, we have no concerns. We think everything's fine. Your home is more than, you know, good. Your home is decent. You have everything you need for your baby. And the only concern that they had was that I had, what are they called? Like the crib bumpers, the padding that goes on the inside of,
yeah,
right around.
Yeah, the crib pads.
I had one of those. And usually they put them in there so, you know, your baby doesn't get the foot caught in the, you know, the things and break their foot or something because they're so tiny. And they told me that I had to remove that I wasn't allowed to have one of those because it was dangerous. And I said, well, they're selling them in the stores. It's so dangerous. Why are they selling them? And they said, well, your baby can suffocate from no airing. I mean, the crib bumper pads are maybe that tall. You know, they're not even. Yeah, so they forced me to remove that. So I said, you know what, if you guys are just going to leave me alone and you say everything else is fine, I'll take it off, just make you happy. And, you know, see you later. That was that. No contact, nothing. We went on the 2 weeks, thought nothing was going on. I thought everything was good. 2:30 in the morning on March 8th, I started dying. Felt like I was dying, jumped into a bath at 2:30 in the morning, got on the phone, said, Tyson, I think this is it. Called my mom crying. I said, Mom, I'm dying. I think this is it. Let's go. Tyson came here, picked me up. I puked all over the house. And my brother was actually staying with me at this time because it was getting close to that time and I didn't want to be home alone and, you know, just was afraid that if it happened, you know, first thing in the morning or something horrible like it ended up doing, that I'd have somebody here with me, and had to get my brother up and wake him up, and everybody came to get me, and we're rushing to the hospital, and everything was good, and, you know, Tyson's all excited, his baby's going to be born, my brother's all freaking out, he thinks his sister's going to kill him, and my mom's rushing to the hospital, not sure what to make of everything yet, and getting to the hospital, I begged the woman for an epidural, took the epidural, and was happy I didn't feel anything anymore, and was laying there. We had arrived at the hospital about 2:30-ish, and maybe about 3:30, 4:30, I finally was settling down, didn't really feel too much pain, was able to kind of relax again, and, you know, have a nap, and I woke up to the police officers. Tyson was sleeping, there was a chair, and my mom was with my brother trying to find snacks because my brother wanted a chocolate bar or something, and Tyson was sleeping at the foot of my bed in a chair, and the police had come in and picked him up and dragged him out of his sleep. And I remember waking up to it because I heard somebody come in, and, you know, I was just kind of half dozed off, and I watched them come in and pick him up when he was asleep, and he kind of got up out of a jolt. He didn't know what was going on. He was shocked, and they dragged him out of my hospital room, and all I heard was them beating him, and he started screaming, all I want to do is see my baby born, all I want to do is see my baby. And it was just like this horrible, horrible experience, and they just beat him outside of my door. I'm sorry.
It's okay, you need a break then. It's okay.
They beat him outside of my door, and he was screaming.
You want peanuts?
I don't have any.
Brown paper? Let me get you some brown paper.
No, I'm good, thanks. So they were beating him outside of my door, and it was just this horrible, horrible experience. Like, just, like, the worst feeling ever. Here I'm supposed to be giving birth to, like, the greatest moment of my life. And nobody knew what was going on. They had just come in and they just grabbed him and dragged him out of his sleep and just started beating him. I mean, instantly after they dragged him out. And he was just screaming and just like, there's just these nightmares I have of him just saying all he wanted to do is see his baby born, and they're just beating him. And it's just like that, like, nobody should be denied of something like that. That's a once-in-a-lifetime thing that's irreplaceable. That's something that doesn't come back ever. You may be, yes, be able to have another child, but it's not the same. It's just not that magical moment that you wait 9 months for, and there you go, you have this beautiful baby you have. So I'd gotten up out of bed. I didn't know what was going on. I stood up out of bed, and I started crying. I didn't know what was going on, and I said, what are they doing to him? What's going on? And we're not even together. We were not an item. We were not dating. We were nothing. And, you know, they were beating him, and he was screaming, and I heard him crying, and my mom, I heard her come. I guess she had just come up from running around downstairs trying to find a vending machine with my brother, and I heard her screaming and crying, saying, what are you doing to him? And I couldn't move. I couldn't get out of my bed. I had the epidural, and I could only stand up. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't go out, and I felt just helpless, like there was nothing I could do. And I heard my mom screaming, and then I heard everybody screaming, and I heard chairs being, like, knocked over, I heard everything, just this huge commotion, and him screaming, and my mom screaming and crying, and my brother saying, what the hell is going on, what are you guys doing, and, I mean, just this horrible, horrible, horrible thing. It was, like, the worst day, by far, of my life, and so they left, and he had got taken away, and I got on the phone. Here I am at, like, 5 o'clock in the morning on the phone with the police station asking why they were taking him away, asking what's going on, calling everybody that I knew to find out information. And my mom saying, I don't know what's going on. Nobody knew what was going on. I finally got a hold of somebody, and they said the children's aide had left a note with the hospital saying that if he were to show up at the hospital, that he was not allowed to be there and to have him arrested. Yet there was no stipulation that he wasn't allowed to be at the hospital. And they, children's aid, and we hadn't heard anything from the children's aid. Last thing I heard, everything was fine. They were happy with everything. They had no concerns. That was the end of it. And I go in, you know, thinking absolutely it was like this big shock, this horrible, you know, caught you out of nowhere. And that was the end of it. You know, they just came in and they just ruined it. Like, it's just like watching your life just, like, break apart before you. It was I can't even begin to express how horrible it was. It was, so he's gone. I've been calling people at 5 o'clock in the morning, and here I'm already going through a terrible time. I'm in labor. I'm already feel like I'm dying. You know, I just had the most horrible thing go on in front of me. And I just, with whatever strength I had, I was just pushing on, you know, my baby was coming into the world, and this part of me just didn't want to bring her in, because then, of course, I had fear. I knew what the children's aid was about. I know, I had experience, I knew what they were doing, I knew, and I just had this fear come over me, and I was scared. I didn't want her to be born then. I wanted to wait, I wanted to run away to some place where they'd never find me and just have birth to my baby, and so I ended up, of course, had no choice, went through and had my daughter, and it was the greatest time of my life, and I was overwhelmed to have her. And that night, because I'd gone in at 2:30 in the morning on the 8th of March, and I had her 5:12 that evening. They came in maybe 8 o'clock, they had an on-call worker, intake worker come in and ask me, and I said what you guys did was whatever, and they said, well, we had concerns with the father and I about the safety of the child, and I said, well, what do you think you just did to me there? You think that was safe to come into my, you know, hospital room and pull him out, and that's safe for my child? You know, what if I was half asleep and got out and fell out of bed or something, you know, completely out of shock, the fact that I'm on medication, you know, that obviously is going to inhibit the way you think and how you go about doing things. You know, it's a painkiller. It's, you know, there to kind of numb things for you. And, you know, and that's not dangerous. That's not a threat. Doing something like that when I'm having my baby is not a threat. you know, if you're so concerned that he's a threat, you know, and he's a threat where there's how many doctors and, you know, registered people around, so you're telling me that, you know, regular hospitals aren't safe now? Is that what you're trying to imply, that, you know, this person can't be safe in a hospital? If you were so concerned and that was so, you know, your big thing, you could have easily just sent an officer over there to stay, you know, to witness, to be there, to make sure that there was no problems going on, and then take them away by all means, you know, go for it. But you don't do that, you know, what they did was just wrong. And I was crying, and of course, you know, I couldn't, usually I'm pretty good and I can keep my composure, but, I mean, this was like 3 hours after I had my daughter, and this woman was in there, and in my face, and I just couldn't control my emotions, I couldn't do anything, I was broken down, I was tired, I was, you know, happy at the same time that I had this beautiful, healthy daughter, and just, like, this woman was just trying to pick at me, and I just couldn't deal with her. I was like, you've got to leave. So, she left, and of course, the next day, this was also on a Friday, I had my daughter on a Friday, so I was there for the weekend in the hospital. The next day was fine, and everything went about, and, you know, I'm trying to get a hold of, you know, he didn't even, her father didn't even know that she was a girl. Like, we had saw ultrasounds, and they told us she would be a girl, but they never ever really, you know, truly know, so it was still a surprise in the end, and he never knew she was a girl, he never knew that she was healthy, or what she looked like, or anything else, and so we were trying to get a hold of him. I mean, all that Saturday, we were, you know, trying to make sense of things. And on Saturday, I think it was, the CAS called and said not to leave the hospital on the Sunday. It was either the Sunday or the Monday, I can't remember when I left, until they arrived. That was a big thing, and that's when I knew something was going on. That's when I had this sick feeling in my stomach. And I was telling my mom that day, I was like, Mom, we need to leave. We need to leave here. And the hospital said, no, we couldn't leave. And I was like, Mom, we just need to take August. And we need to leave. I know something's up. I know this feeling. I've had this feeling before. I know what this is. I know what's going on. I know what's going to happen. And sure enough, they came in, and it was just the two workers. And it was the one worker that we had seen that had come into my home like a couple weeks or so before. It was that worker and another worker. And they were there, and they said, I was breastfeeding my daughter at the time, and then she had fallen asleep, and they asked me if I could leave my daughter with the nurse, and I said okay. You know, I didn't think, you know, anything. I had these fears, but I didn't think that they would just take my daughter. We went into another room, and we started talking. They started throwing all these allegations, everything. They started saying, I put my daughter at risk from getting out of bed when they were beating my daughter's father outside of the door. They said that was a risk. They said that by me calling the police after the whole fight that we had and having, like, telling them that it wasn't a big thing or whatever, and that they had over, you know, that they had made it sound like more than it was. They were telling me that I must be scared of my daughter's father, and that I was just doing that in fear, that I was doing that to protect him. And they started coming out with all sorts of these things, like all sorts of these horrible, horrible things. And I got up after a point, and I said, you know, you've yet to come up with anything that's legitimate. Nothing here is legitimate. They tried to say, oh, I have an anxiety disorder, so I can't be a fit parent. You know, if anything, an anxiety disorder, I worry. That should make me more of a parent, because I'm going to worry with every person that my child's around. You know, that's going to mean that I'm going to be a protective parent. I'm going to be a good parent. I went to prenatal classes, I did parenting, you know, I did everything that I thought was in the best interest for me to do a better job for my child, and they weren't even around. I just did that on my own. That was my own doing. That was my own feelings to do what I could do to be a better parent and provide for my child. And they were just bringing all these horrible things, and I got up, and I said, where's my baby? I don't even want to talk to you people anymore. And they told me that and I had been there talking to them for maybe an hour. They told me that my baby was already gone, that they had the police take away my baby. I started, you know, lashing out, and I said, well, you can't take my daughter without having a warrant. Where's my warrant? And they said, well, here it is. And I said, aren't you supposed to, present that to me before you take my child? I said, I think what you just did is kidnapping, and you just took my daughter without telling me that you were taking my daughter. You just took her without letting me know or letting me say goodbye or letting me even see her, even letting me look over this warrant to show that this warrant is even legitimate or that the dates and times on this warrant is legitimate and that you can even take her. And then I started getting really mad because then the woman had no idea what to say to me. And I started getting sick. I started throwing up in the garbage pail next to me. My stomach just started turning. I felt like I was going to faint. I felt like everything around me just went black. It was just, the thought that my daughter is like 2 days old and she's gone after everything else they had put me through. So I got up and I got really mad and I kind of couldn't control myself. I just lost all senses. Like, just this feeling like that, you got to protect your children feeling, that mother, that maternal instinct kind of kicked in. And I was like, you let crackheads have their children and you're going to take my baby away from me. And I said some awful things because I was just mad, but I told her that they were worthless and that they were, that they weren't going to do. I remember telling her, I said, you know what even happens in these foster homes? I said, you're never going to put my child in a foster home. I said, I'll find my daughter and I will leave with my daughter and you will never do what you did to her, what you've done to me. And I said everything. I mean everything that I came to the top of my head. I just said it. My mom was trying to control me. She's like, Candace, just sit down. You're going to make it worse. And my mom was crying. She says, how can you people do this? She's just a baby. And, she's just young and you can't do this to her. August doesn't deserve what you're doing to her. This isn't right what you're doing. So they took her. And then I finally kind of gained some control of myself. And I said, I want to see her every day. I said, I looked at the papers. The papers distinctly said that within 5 days they had to have a court date. It was either Sunday or Monday. I'm starting to think it was a Monday they came in to the hospital. I think it was Monday. I went home. I took the papers. I had a lawyer that night. I had legal aid the next morning. I went to go see my daughter that afternoon. I started demanding all sorts of things. I said, I want to breastfeed my daughter. I started bringing in pumped breast milk. I said, you're going to give this to my daughter. I said, I didn't want my daughter on normal nipples. I wanted her on orthodontic nipples so that the sucking wouldn't make her, buck teeth and all sorts of other orthodontic issues. I had bought full sets of orthodontic nipples for my daughter when she was to be born. I demanded that my daughter was on that. I demanded that I wanted to see my daughter every day so I could breastfeed because that was I thought it was in the best interest of my daughter because it's proven psychological, that it's psychologically healthy for your child. Not only is it physically healthy for your child to have breast milk opposed to, Emflac or other, types of milk. And I told them, I said, I want to know exactly what's going on with my daughter. I want to see her every day. The foster mother refused, said that, they said, well, your daughter won't take these nipples. She doesn't like them. When she was here every day with me, she did. She had no problem with them. And I demanded them. And they just didn't like me, I don't think. But I wanted to see her every day. I demanded to see her every day. They started saying that I couldn't, that it just didn't fit their schedule. And I said, well, I'm breastfeeding, and that's a newborn. She's a newborn baby. You just took her away from her mother, and she's a newborn. Do you guys even worry about things like, detachment disorders and things? And this is why these disorders happen, because people are taking kids away from their parents when they're just born. That's a period when that child needs to be with their parent. That's a necessity. That's a need. And the time came around, I found a lawyer that was, gung-ho and just wanted to be with me on it and, had all spirits in it as I did. And I mean, that week that my daughter was gone, it was like I was just not even alive. It was just this hollow shell of me that was doing all that I knew what to do. It was just, I got to do what I have to do to get my daughter back. I'm going to fight for my daughter, and I'm just going to go for it. So I had a lawyer. The set court date was for that Thursday. They pushed it back to the Friday. Then they pushed it back to the Monday. So I got mad on the Friday. I said, I'm not going to be able to see my daughter for the whole weekend. This is more time you're taking away from me and my daughter. This is not acceptable. I called and I went right past the worker and I talked to the supervisor and I said, you can't do this. This court paper here says that it has to be within 5 days. I said, you can't do this. And they said, well, we can't get a court date. And I said, well, you keep pushing back the court dates and you have yet to even provide me with any information. You have yet to serve me with papers as to why you're even what you're taking me to court for. I said, is that what you're doing? You're just pushing back time, trying to get more information? I said, you can't do this. I said, you have to, you said 5 days. It's got to be 5 days. They tried to say, oh, no, well, we can't do it. We got to go by what days we can get in court. And I said, well, if this is legal enough for you to take my daughter with, then this is legal enough for you to have it within 5 days, and that's no ifs, ands, or buts. So my lawyer said that they do it all the time and that there was really, it's not even worth fighting at the time. So we went to court, and I went in there with everything I had, and I mean, within that week, I had gotten together papers. I have subsidized housing here with the Homes Good Shepherd program. I had papers from them. I mean, I had hit up everybody I knew and gotten every last bit of evidence I could. I hit up my gynecologist, who I had been with the entire time. I had her sign me up the papers telling them that I'd been to every single prenatal, you know, every single appointment that I had, and that I always showed no signs of ever being a threat to my child and always had all the best. I went to everybody. I went to my prenatal teacher. I had that taken. I got papers from everybody. I had everybody I knew write up saying that there was no, you know, that they had no fear of how I was as a parent. And I took all of that into court, and I even signed up, I even did a plan of action. I mean, I did everything. And when we went to court, I handed it all over, and we just put it all on the table. And they ordered my daughter back that day with a 6-month order, plan of care. And sure enough, I got my daughter back, and they made me take off the crib things again, and went through my house, and I was told I couldn't have a boyfriend, I was told that I couldn't date, because they thought my choices of men were not acceptable, and that that it was not, you know, that they figured that I was going to make some bad choices. So they gave me a to-do list, of course, and I was always up to date with my daughter's, you know, appointments, physical appointments, and everything else. So they gave me a to-do list. The one was I had to take parenting again. So I did the same parenting course a second time. So it was just whatever. They made me go to therapy, which the therapist told me and even wrote me a letter for court stating that she thought I had absolutely no psychological problems and that 95% of the psychological issues that I have, like, you know, that I have worries and that I had nightmares and, you know, my anxiety is all related to 95% of it, of the children's aid, and that she thought that I had this very good grasp on my life and that what issues I do have outside the children's aid, that I have a pretty good grasp on, and that I'm, that she feels that I'm more than capable of, you know, tackling those myself, you know, no different than everybody else's day-to-day issues. And she thought that I was an extremely bright person and that I was more than capable, and that she said the only people that are causing any kind of disruption in my life psychologically is the society. I would have nightmares. I had nightmares for a year of these horrible nightmares of the society coming and taking my daughter away, and my daughter in the back of a car taking them away, and me trying to bang on the back of the window trying to scream at my daughter and nobody's listening, and they just kept driving. I had that nightmare every day, and that didn't even happen to me. It was just this, like, horrible nightmare, this fear of them just coming in every time I ever did anything. I was scared to do anything. Every time I did anything with my daughter, I was scared they were going to come back. That there was this, just this horrible fear, this worry that never ever left. Every day of my life for a year, I worried. Everything I did, I worried. My diaper would get it, or my daughter would get a diaper rash, I worried. I'd fear that they'd come in and take her away. So I did that, and the last one was I had to go to a women's domestic violence group, which I went to, and I did all of them with no, you know, I just kind of did it with a strong head, just went and did what I had to do, just, even if to me it was like just ridiculous, and I didn't need it, and I knew I didn't need it, but if that's what it meant to keep my daughter, then I'd do it 70 million times over, and it would never mean a thing to me. It would just, I'd just keep doing it mindlessly if I had to. So I did those, and you know, I would always get these threats and these, you know, the society would be pushing me, saying that they wanted me to take Tyson for child support and custody, and if I didn't, then they thought that it was a threat and that they would take her away, and they were always threatening me with something. And one time my daughter got a diaper rash, and I took my daughter to the hospital because I was concerned. You know, I didn't, it was really bad. It was just, I think it was part of the heat, and babies get diaper rashes as it is. And I came down to the fact that the end result was the diapers I had bought, and I had bought new diapers, and my daughter reacted to them. But I take her to the hospital, and the doctors at the hospital just said, you know, this happens all the time. There's no need to be concerned. But what I learned in parenting is, as a parent, even the smallest little thing that you worry about, you should always just go. You know, if it's a peace of mind and, you know, to you and some medical attention for your child, do it. You know, whether it's the smallest little thing, they tell you to do that. So I was just going with what I knew. You know, I've never been a parent before. I see something, I worry the minute I do is I walk over to the hospital. For every little thing, I was going to the hospital. My daughter, I thought, my daughter was really crying, just constantly crying one night, and she wouldn't stop, and I thought she had colic, or I thought maybe something happened or something was wrong. I took her to the hospital, and the hospital's like, your daughter's fine, and they're telling me I was worrying too much. But that's just, you know, that's what you know. As a parent, you know, what if something was wrong? You know, what if they can't tell you, your child can't get up and tell you, you know, mom, you know, hey, I've got a really bad stomach problem, something's up here. They can't tell you that at that age, so you just got to do what you know. So I went this one time with the diaper rash, and by law, the Good Shepherd Homes program also has to, you know, address anything. And they just, and it wasn't even saying that it was bad, they just called and let them know that I had gone to the hospital with a diaper rash. You know, it wasn't saying, oh, yeah, we're really concerned that she's not taking care of her child. It's just, you know, this is what we have to do by law. So they're kind of doing it with, like, a frown and kind of saying, oh, well, yeah. She went to the hospital, whatever. They came in. I mean, they were harassing me for, like, 4 days, saying they wanted to have a children's aid nurse come in and look. Because, you know, the hospital nurses, just, they're just not educated, and they have no standings, and they're just, you know, nothing at all. What they say doesn't matter at all. They have to have their nurse come in. And they did. And, of course, by this time, I had already ignored them for the 3 days that the medication, that the cream that the doctors had given me from the hospital, the rash was already gone. And I said, yeah, well, that's the rash. Enjoy. And just ignored them for days, and that was it. And another time is they completely denied Tyson of seeing her. He didn't see her forever. He never saw his daughter until she was, like, much older. And there's this one time, we run a video gaming business, and there's always children in his store. I mean, people bring their kids. That's what kids do. They play video games. They have, you know, siblings. His sister has young children. That was August's age. And I guess somebody had reported, or they claimed somebody had reported that they had seen a baby there. They didn't know the sex of the baby, no clue what the sex of the baby was, no clue the baby belonged to. They just saw a baby through the window across the street. They automatically came into my home, said they were going to take August away. I was crying, I was freaking out, saying, you can't take my baby. I said, she's not even seen her father, and you're coming in here. I was completely shocked. And of course, your father gave me the heads up and called me, said that the children's aid was just here, so I was getting prepared for them. I called my mom and I said, Mom, look, I think the children's aid is coming. I want you to come here immediately and take August if needs be, and just go wherever you can go with her. And I was prepared. If it meant I had to leave the country that night, I would have done it. And they came in and they were making all sorts of allegations. Oh, well, we saw a baby there. You know, we told you can't have August around him. We think he's a threat. And I said, well, what does this have to do with me and my daughter? I said, you're going into a video game store saying you've seen a child there. You don't even know who the child belongs to or what sex the child is, let alone, you know, you don't even know how old this baby is, you know, or anything related to my daughter, and you're coming and saying you're going to take her. That's like walking into Chuck E. Cheese saying you've seen a kid and you're going to come and take away my daughter. That's just, it's completely illegitimate and so bogus it's not even funny. And they came in here and they were going to take her away, and I said, you know, And they're like, okay, well, we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt, but if this ever happens again, that's the end of it. And I mean, this constant fear that they put in you, and these fears and these nightmares, things, nightmares would never go away. I always had these fears every time my daughter would, you know, fall down from learning how to walk and get, like, a tiny little bruise on her shin or something. You know, this fear. I'd feel like I was a bad parent. I'd have to cover it up, you know, just to make sure for the safety of my daughter. I had to keep her safe. And I always had to hide it. I always had to hide everything that happened because, you know, if my daughter fell and got a bump, that was the end of it. I'd automatically be beating my child, which I'd never laid a hand on my child ever. Or my daughter gets a diaper rash automatically. I'm not changing my daughter's diapers or I'm an unfit parent, which, you know, my daughter was born very tiny. My daughter's always been petite. I was a petite baby. I was tiny all throughout, you know, and the doctors told me that my daughter was underweight, but they said, there's nothing wrong with your daughter. Your daughter's healthy. She always meets the required weight gain points. She's just tiny. She's just a petite girl. You know, it was always like, well, are you feeding your kid? Are you? I said, I feed my kid every day. She's just petite. Just because she's not your standard, you know, with the children's age, she's fit, doesn't mean my daughter's not healthy. If you've seen my daughter is a tiny little girl. She's just petite. My daughter's very petite, but she's very tall. You know, so it's just how she is. And my doctor told me, she said, it's just her structure. It's just how she is. She goes, the doctor told me that one of her daughters were the same way, and she was underweight. And here's a physician telling me not to worry, and the children's aide is telling me that I'm some unfit parent. It's almost like they were looking for things to get me on where there was nothing to go. You know, my daughter has always been well provided for. My daughter has what she needs. She's never, ever been without. And my daughter's always met the required growth. Always, she's above the required height. So she's just a tall, petite girl. And they were always trying to get me on things. So that went on. I finished their little to-do list within the month that they gave it to me. So they were kind of shocked, and I did it right away, and they kept telling me, you know, take your time, and you don't need to go so fast, and I had it done within a month that they gave it to me. And then they started putting on me, well, are you really thinking of your daughter's best interest since you're doing all this at once, and you shouldn't be doing all this at once, and now you're putting too much on your plate. And I said, I'm going to do whatever it takes to keep my daughter safe and get you out of my life, and that's why I'm doing it. I had everything done. The minute I got that, I had people contacted. I got my name put on a list. I got into the places. I had the little certificates done that I kept, and I showed them stating that I had gone. And they had nothing left on me. Then they started just going on, oh, well, your girlfriend's here too much, and my best friend would be here, and they'd say that, oh, well, she's here too much. And they'd just go on every little thing, and there was just nothing to go on. So they would just make up things, and then I think they ran out of stuff to do, and they sent a parent support worker here. He used to come here every week and see me to make sure everything was good, and it was just a complete waste of time because everything she talked about I already knew. I was like, what's this different than the last two times I took, you know, parenting class plus the prenatal class I took? And what's the need of this? This is just a waste of my time and this person's time. The person was very nice, and we'd end up talking about other things, but, you know, it was just a complete waste of time. There's no need for it. So that was just, you know, it. And then finally came to the day where they just had nothing left to do. They couldn't get me on anything more. I just cut off the bridges as they tried to cross them. They had nothing left, and finally they left, and we celebrated, and haven't heard from them since, except for that one time which they never called, which is when I contacted you, but that's pretty much the end of it there.
Yeah. Now, are they still expecting the father not to have contact with the child?
I don't even know. I think they still expect that, but when I talked to the police told me that by law, legally, I can't keep him from her because I don't have any court orders stating that, you know, okay. And that I don't have custody, like, I don't have a piece of paper saying I have sole custody of her, so legally, she's in both of our custodies. And because the children's aid isn't involved, they have no stipulations against what I do, and it's pretty much been left in, you know, under my discretion, and that's how it's been since.
Let me ask you a question then about the workers that involved themselves when you had your daughter now. did you find that they were young workers, old workers?
Young. Both of them were very young. I mean, these girls, like, that was a big thing between my mom. Me and my mom would talk and say, these girls look no older than I am, and they're trying to tell me how to be a parent. So, yeah.
When they did come around with your baby, did you get the same sense that you had when you were in foster care that people trying to fabricate false...
For sure, completely. Every little thing I did, they twisted around. Everything I said, they said differently. Like, they played everything in words. You know, like, where I felt that the case between me and Tyson was completely bogus, and I went back to make things right and, you know, say that, look, this isn't how it happened. I told you how it happened, and this is kind of just way overboard. You know, and I was upset, and I was angry at him, and... you know, this is just not right. And they turned around and said, oh, well, I was just trying to protect him, so that makes me some automatic, you know, statistical parent that they see as protecting the boyfriend, and that where I'm not putting my child's best interest in, you know, first, and that I'm just protecting him. But it wasn't that way at all.
Did you ever get the sense that they didn't want to give you credit to think for yourself?
For sure. Completely. It was never, ever, everything I said that it was just like, it just reminds me of exactly when I was in foster care the first time where they just insult my intelligence. It's like, I've been through all this. I made the effort to do these things myself. You're trying to talk me back into parenting. And it's like, I've already made these decisions myself. I'm obviously capable of thinking for myself, because if I've already done this before you even came along and told me to do this, and now you're turning around and telling me to do this again, I've already obviously been on the right track before you even came along. Obviously thought steps before you and did it my own way and did it way before you even came in and said that. So if I'm already doing this and I've already accomplished this and I'm already steps ahead of you, then who are you to tell me that I can't, that I'm not capable of it, yet I've already been doing it before you ever came in the picture?
In closing, could you maybe describe, I guess... summarize what your feelings are about the Children's Aid Society and your experience with the Children's Aid Society over the last, I guess it's been a little over 7 years then.
The best word that comes to my mind is malicious. They're completely cruel. I don't even see any justice in it. I think people need to define that thin line between people who need it and people who don't, and that needs to be determined. And I think the society is unpoliced. I think they're disgusting in what they do to people. I think they're destroying people's lives. I think they're putting parents in fear and causing more parent problems as well as child problems. These parents can think about what's going on, and they know and they see it and it hurts. But these children don't know. They have to grow up like that, and that ends up being what they know. And it's destroying their lives, and these are our future. And if we don't protect what we have for the future, then there is no future for us. This is going to be how we're going to live, and there's going to be only a few select people that are going to make it anywhere, because we're destroying everything we have. These people can grow up to be our next presidents or our next, you know, psychologists or rocket scientists, and they could do great things in this world, and we're doing nothing but setting them behind for what? Some power scandal? Some, you know, somebody's money in the pocket? And it's just ridiculous, and I think somebody needs to get rid of them. Somebody needs to police them, or at least change the laws, or start making it legitimate, and stop making it just this power-hungry organization that's just ruining people's lives.
Let me ask you just one more question, and again, in regards to your second session of dealing with the Children's Aid Society, do you feel that had your meetings with them and interviews that they came around, had they been either videotaped or audiotaped, so that there was a record of what they said and what you said to them, do you think that that would help? Do you think that would have helped protect you, or would have made them more professional?
Both. Both. If I had a videotape of everything they said, or a copy or something, they would probably all have lost their jobs. I would have probably had my daughter back months before I got her back. I would have had her days before I got her back, and they would have been out of my lives months before they had left my life if I had copies of what they had, because some of the things they've said, some of the things they've threatened me with, just aren't, not even close you know, to professional. I don't think I've ever seen a children's aid worker be professional.
Would you support legislation that would make it mandatory for these children's aid workers to
yeah.
record their conversations with?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I 110% support that. But another thing is they asked me if I felt if I felt that there was any danger, like, to my child, and I said no. I said that I didn't feel that he was a threat. They said here, and they quoted this, that, or not quoted it, but they said it, that it says that the mother was minimizing the events of the September 18th, the day, and I told you that we weren't living together. I was living on my own, but we were still talking, you know. He was still giving me money when I needed it for, you know, maternity clothes or whatever came up, you know. We were still talking, or like baby stuff, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they said that, and has continued to have contact with the father, thereby demonstrating that she does not recognize the danger that the father may pose to herself or the child, and does not recognize the cycle of violence. So it's like the most, that's the biggest, I don't know. That just makes no sense. It's like contradicting itself, you know. They say that I said that there's no threat, and they automatically kind of, it's like putting words into my mouth. It's like changing what I said.
Yeah, and what you're saying is that there was contact, but it was for meaningful things.
For my daughter, yeah. It's not like we were dating. We weren't together anymore. I was doing my own thing. You know, it was, hey, I'm just calling to see how you're doing. How, you know, your ultrasounds go? Is the doctor going well? Is the baby healthy? Yeah, the baby's healthy. Do you need anything? Yeah, I'm a little low on vitamins this month. Can you help me out? Or, I can't say no, my maternity clothes is getting too big. Can you help me out? Or, you know, one was, I'm kind of low on some money for a crib. Do you think maybe we can split on it? Yeah, sure, no problem. We need to pick up baby clothes for you, though. Here's $100, help you out. You know, so it was always for positive things, you know, as far as our relationship when it was over. But as far as when it came down to our daughter, it was always like, you know, we did what we needed to do, and we did the appropriate things to make sure that our daughter was born into a healthy, you know, stable home. So whether we were together or not.
And again, based on what the Children's Aid Society were doing, do you think that they were actually creating a worse environment for your child?
Oh, absolutely. Like here, they say that the father demonstrates violent behavior towards a police officer in the delivery room of McMaster University. They beat him up. I watched them beat him up. You know, they dragged him out of the hospital and right outside my door, they beat him up. They dragged him out of his sleep and beat him up, and he wasn't even awake when they started beating him. And then they're telling me that he kicked her in the face, the police officer in the face, when they're beating him when he's asleep. He's probably kicking and saying, what the hell's going on, and completely unaware of what's going on, and people are beating him with, you know, he's got a scar across his head. He was black and blue. He was, like, covered. Like, that's not acceptable. That's violence. You know, that's violence all on its own. You're talking about him being violent. You're talking about everybody else being violent. He did nothing wrong. So it's completely ridiculous. And they said that he resisted arrest and attempted to kick a police officer in the face. The father was arrested and charged with breach, assaulting the police officer, and resisting arrest. The society was also advised that when the father was being arrested, the mother wanted to remove her epidural and go with him, which is not true at all. That's when I got out of bed. They said that when I got out of bed, I was endangering my child, and they turned around and said that I was doing all this other stuff. The child's extremely young age and high vulnerability increases the risk in the situation. The mother has an anxiety disorder, which is exacerbated by what? I don't even know that word. By situations of high stress. The society is concerned that the birth of the new baby may have a negative effect on the mother's anxiety. You know what? When I had my daughter, I had no time to even worry. And there was, like, zero anxiety at all, because there was no, you know, when you worry, you sit there and think of it, and I usually worry when there's nothing else to do. I'm sitting here alone, and I'll just start thinking, and I'll worry about something. It's almost like my mind needs to, you know, something to focus on, and there's nothing there, so I'll just pick something to worry with. When my daughter was young, I had no time to worry. There was no time to have an anxiety attack, because you were just doing what you had to do. And 95% of people with anxiety disorders say that. You know, if they go to school, they don't have anxiety disorders when they think they would. Because there's no time to. There's no focus on that whatsoever. And 95% of anxiety disorders are complete focus. It's like you're bringing it on to yourself when you're completely in control. So, yeah.
Did they say anything about dating, or?
Yeah, oh.
Or is it just verbal?
No, they didn't say anything here. It was all verbal. But, there was this one person that I had met through a friend that I was kind of interested, but not really. Like, I wasn't really interested in dating. You know, I haven't had a, you know, young child. I've got too much on my plate to really have a serious relationship with anybody. And we just talked, you know, went out for dinner a few times, and it was pretty basic, you know, best friends. And I kind of slipped up one time talking, and I said, yeah, well, they asked me what I'd done. And I said, oh, well, I went out to dinner the other night. They automatically wanted to know who he was, his last name. They wanted to do a criminal background check on him. They wanted to, and I'm like, I'm not giving you his name or last name. That's an invasion of his privacy, let alone my own, that I have with a person that I'm not even dating. Like, I don't have any relationship with this person yet, and you're already trying to get into it. And then that completely ruined that relationship. I went out with him a few times just for dinner and once to a movie, and, I mean, nothing ever happened. It was just his friends. We never even held hands or anything amongst that. And here I'm already saying, sorry, I can't even talk to you anymore because I don't want to put you into any of this mess, and I don't want to start any mess of my own. You know, so I just completely disregarded any relationships and didn't have a relationship until way out. Actually, this relationship that I have now is the first relationship I've had in 2.5 years. Because in fear of, like, you know, having any repercussions of actually trying to have a life, so.
So at the time, you're saying, when they found out that you were pregnant, then they didn't bother pursuing charges against you.
Yeah, they just, we're so sorry. That's such a horrible thing that happened to you. And it was just like, you know, trying to console me. And I'm like, you know, and I was just holding my ground. I was angry and I hit him and they were going to arrest me.
Yeah.
And they never did. And then the minute they found out I was pregnant, that was the end of it. They completely turned it around. So when everything came back and, you know, the Children's Day brought all these allegations and brought these court documents saying that I was, or these police documents saying all this stuff, you know, that was it. I went back to the police, and I was like, this isn't even it. And they said, okay, well, we're going to drop everything. You have no worries, no concerns. The police were aware that we were contacting each other only for the basis of the baby. It's not like we went out every day. I mean, we're talking about once a month. He called me on the phone. He dropped me off money. See you later. He wasn't here for more than 5 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Let me ask you then on that. So, but they did charge him at that time.
Yeah, but he wasn't. Yeah, they were getting dropped.
Yeah, they were getting, but they did charge him. They did go to the process, fingerprinting and everything else.
Yeah, I think so.
And they went through that. Had he, in a sense, attacked you at that time? I mean, or was it more sense of defense?
It was, I think it was defense. I was, you know, we were in a pretty stressful situation, both of us, and he said something and it kind of just, you know, hit that point and I just hit him and he was trying to hold me back and I was screaming at him and it was more defense if anything. Like, I'm pretty much to blame, not trying to say that he wasn't either. He was definitely a part of it.
Yeah.
Took two to tango, so, you know, we definitely were both to blame, but
I'm just saying, when it came to the physical, the actual physical assault of it, I mean, did he actually,
He never once, like...
I mean, you're saying that you actually went out and whacked the guy.
Yeah. Like, he never closed fist punched me in the face, or he never kicked me in the head, or anything terrible, or... Yeah,
but I mean, did he actually...
I don't even think so.
...go after you, or is it more of you and...
It was me after him, and he was grabbing me.
And you just kind of got into a...
Yeah, kind of just got into it.
Just into where everybody's all over the place.
Yeah. There was really kind of no method to the madness.
Right. So do you think, I'm just curious then too, do you think that the way that you were treated by, I guess it was the Hamilton police?
Yeah.
Do you think that the way that the treatment you got was different from the treatment he got based on sex?
Oh, absolutely, because the second, and it was two females, it was a female and a male, I think. And it was just like, oh, this is a terrible thing, and then they're taking me away, and they're like, you know, we're going to take you down, and they were so stern with me at first, and then they went in, and then all of a sudden it's like, we'll take you to a home, and then they didn't want me to stay at the home, but that's where we lived, and they put me into a woman's shelter, and they're like, here, you're going to have to stay at a woman's shelter, and I'm like, well, this is my home, and they didn't want me to go back to the home, they're like, yeah, he's a threat, and he's dangerous, and I'm like, no, he's not. You know, when they made me do this video statement, and in the video statement I was, like, upset, and I was like, you know, look, I'm just upset. I went back, and I was, like, upset, but I never once said that he was going to kill me, or, you know, I just told you exactly what happened, and you guys, like, I said, yeah, we fought, and they completely twisted everything around, and it's like, the minute they found out I was pregnant, that was it.
Did you ever admit to them that you had hit him?
Oh, yeah. He had a big scratch across the side of his neck. That's why they took me too.
Was that disclosed on the video in the interview?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And he told them flat out when they showed up. He's like, she's crazy. She's trying to kill me. Like, she attacked me. He was the one who called the cops. I remember now. He called the cops because I attacked him. He was the one who called the cops. He called the cops on me because he told them that I was attacking him. And then when they came, they arrested us both. And then the minute they found out I was pregnant, that's when. So he was the one, I remember now, he was the one who called the cops. He called on his cell phone and he said that I was crazy and that I was trying to beat him up. And they came, and then the minute they found out I was pregnant, that was the end of it. So everything went the other way.
So in a sense, in your opinion, had you actually broken the law by assaulting him?
Yeah.
And they actually...
But it wasn't I wasn't really intending to inflict harm. I kind of just wanted to slap him and, you know, say, there you go. Thankfully, it is biased because it's not just women are being abused. You know, men are easily being abused by women, too. And we completely made this, you know, biased society where automatically men are, you know, it's always men. You know, there's women who sexually abuse their sons, you know, but you never hear about it. You never hear about those women who sexually abuse or beat, you know, their children. Or you always hear about these men, you know, men rapists, or, you know, you hear all these bias about society, and it's all just stories made up by society. And now, I remember before, the woman had to charge a man to be put in jail. That was the law. The woman had to charge. Now, the woman doesn't have to do anything. The police can go on their own grounds to charge. And they said that they made that law for the simple fact that too many women were afraid to come forth, you know, and say, yeah, he was abusing them, you know, but they didn't come forth because in fear that, you know, but it's not always that case. That's kind of like, you know, a chicken and egg thing, which came first, you know, is it, maybe, yeah, some cases are like that, but what about these women? Like, that's just giving women the power to say, okay, well, you know, you're whatever, I don't like you anymore, and, you know, you cheated on me, so I'm going to go and throw you in jail because I can do that. I can get away with that. That's what I have the power of doing, you know, and it goes both ways. Like, you know, you can't just be so black and white. It's got to be a 50-50 situation. And yeah. I think a lot of things are that way. And, you know, the police deal with that the minute there's any kind of a situation. And I completely felt like that. The police didn't handle themselves very well, you know. And I think the police nowadays forget who they're working for. They're working for the people, not against the people. We pay them to work for us. And I think they need to start remembering that they work for us, not against us. They're not, you know, you know, if a police officer walks in my door, they better treat me with respect because I'm paying them to come in here. You know, not this, yeah, you're going to come in here, you're going to belittle me and treat me like this and then twist my story around. I'm sorry, I don't pay you to do that.
Yeah.
I pay you to protect me. So it's not the only time that the police have treated me like that either. The time I called you, they treated me that way also. And that's when I had fears of the children they coming back into my life. And I've always been somebody, I always try to take initiative first. Like, I always try to have the heads up, you know? I've always been that way. I've always tried to educate myself before so I can be prepared. And the same, that time, you know, like, he was calling me, and I just didn't want him calling me, so I figured I'd say, hey, well, if you don't stop calling me, I'm going to call the police. So he wouldn't stop calling me, so I called the police. You know, I just wanted them to tell him to stop calling me. Leave me alone.
Now, this is the father of your
child? Yeah, this is the father, and this was that situation where you got involved, where I called you. And they came in, and when they came in, I said, look, you know, I'm not in any, there's no fear, I don't think he's going to do whatever, I'm just letting you know that he's bothering me, and I just want you to tell him to leave me alone. They turn around and call the domestic, and I'm like, there is no domestic. Just tell them to leave me alone. I'm just asking you to, you know, say, look, hey, if you got a problem and if you guys are going to fight, fight in court or something, you know. Don't, you know, do it on the phone or whatever, and don't call her all the time, and, you know, just leave it alone. I'll never, you know, it gives you a fear. It's more fear. This society puts you in fear, and now you got a fear of calling the police because now how good are the police to your protection? Like, you know, you're trying to protect your child. And it's like, not only are you trying to protect your child from the predators out there, you know, these people on the streets that you don't even know exist, that could be predators to your child, that could be predators to anything around you, and not only are you protecting your child from these people, but you're protecting your child from the law. You're protecting them from harming your child. you can't call the police because, you know, every time you call the police and you've got a child in your house, you don't even have to have it related to your child. You know, the society already has a grip on, you know, anybody of stature, like the police or, you know, doctors, lawyers, whatever. They have a legal right to, you know, call the society, because if they don't, automatically they're going to lose their job. So you better protect your child from the police and the society. And you're trying, you know, what is a parent to do? What more can you do? You feel completely helpless. And all you know is you have this instinct that you've got to protect your child, because that's what you do. That's what a parent does, you know. It's like this genetic imprint that, you know, that's your child, and to survive out in the wilderness, if, you know, this was like Africa and I was a tiger, you know, you kill for your young. And you don't let that happen. And but it's like now you're protecting your child. I'll never call the police again with my daughter ever in this home. Ever. Unless I was being beaten, raped, murdered, whatever. If there was somebody that came bashing down my door, that would be the only time. Because I don't have any faith in the police either. I do not trust them, because every time I've ever called with my daughter being in here, they automatically call the society. The last time they called the society, they came into my home, they told me that he had a legal right to see her, and I said, okay, that's fine. He doesn't have to call me and harass me about it. He can call me once and say, hey, I want to see her, and then we can arrange a time. He doesn't have to call me 50 times, I just want you to tell him. They turned around and called the society and said it was a domestic, and said that they said my carpets were badly stained and it looked like I lived in a dirty home. My home is always like this. This is how I live. You know, I've got a child. If there's toys on my floor, that's not dirty. That's messy. You know, there's a difference between dirty and messy. Everybody that has a child's got a messy home. You know, I can't change the way that these carpets are. They're going to forever be this way. They were stained like this before I got here. I tried to do my best and buy area rugs to cover up the damages. You know, the building managers won't fix it. I've asked them to, and they won't do anything about it. There's nothing I can change for that. And they went off saying that, you know, my house is just, you know, whatever. And then they said that my house smelled, which I eat a lot of exotic foods, and I cook curry chicken that night, so my house smelled like curry. And it's like, well, yeah, no kidding. That's a very strong spice, you know. Of course, the whole house, the whole building's going to smell like curry if I cook curry. So
they actually complained about the smell.
Yeah, the smell. I'm like, if you walked into any Indian person's home, that's an everyday occurrence, you know what I mean? Like, they cook very strong, potent, you know, very strong spices. That's how I cook every day. I don't cook like the normal Canadian family. I like things differently. I like exotic foods. I enjoy how I eat. I'm very open to new things, you know, like, I'm always willing to try new things. My daughter sits here and eats fresh mussels with me that I've bought live, and that she sits there and cooks with me. Is that wrong? Is that bad? You know, that's how I eat. That's how I live. That's what I do. I'm just giving my daughter a whole new opportunity of seeing things and trying new things, and that, you know, that sense of adventure of being able to try new things and not just turn your head at everything you do. And they came in and complained about that and the carpet. And there's nothing I can do with either of those things. I'm not going to change my food habits for the police, and I'm definitely not going to move out of my apartment just because the carpets are stained. They're not dirty, they're just stained.
Yeah.
So, and that was a child protection issue. I don't see a child protection issue at all. So, I didn't like, and the two women that came in completely talked down to me, completely belittled me. I just think that the police need to get a hold of themselves, because they're forgetting who they work for.
Do you think that your experience with the police appears to be again maybe an abuse of power, authority, and more of a sense of being? Do you like you feel like you're being bullied by these people?
Oh, for sure. I find that a lot with maybe too. I find it due to my age that a lot of people automatically assume that, you know, they have some superiority over me, which they don't, because I don't care how old I am. If you treat me that way, and if you don't treat me, like, with respect, I'm going to treat you the same way back. And I find it a lot, but I think with the police, with cases of a child, I think it's one of two things. I think, one, you get the people who think they're doing good, because it's this complete misconception that the society is, like, you know, all Hail Mary, and everything's great and grand, and the best for children, which it's not. And then I think there's this other misconception of these people who know, and they know that it's not right, and they know that there's nothing here, but they're afraid of losing their jobs. Because you hear of these people and, you know, and they get threatened, you know, and it's this constant fear that we're not the only people living in fear, that maybe they're living in fear too, that, hey, if we don't report every little thing that we see, whether it's a big, huge issue or not, then we're going to lose our jobs, and well, we've got families to feed and kids to feed too, you know, so it's this, like, vicious cycle. And it's no different for them, if you think of it, but then you get some people are just there to abuse the power, and, you know, they're just like, yeah, well, I'm doing a great thing, and I'm, you know, saving the people, which you're only... Because when you think of the people who are going in and they're calling this society, and you think that maybe they're in fear of it, is they're making these bogus, it's not, oh yeah, I think this baby's got, like, bruises all over the place. It's like, oh, they've got a stained carpet. Gotta call it, you know. Like, it's just, there is, people have lost touch of what is really an issue, what's really a child protection issue. You know, if this was, and then the age thing, it's always belittling me with my age. If this was 100 years ago, if I wasn't 15 and had 4 kids already, that wouldn't be normal. So we're just looking at a social normality, and this is just how society is, and who's society to tell me how I can and cannot be. And if this is who I am, and if I was 14 and had a kid, and as long as I could take care of my kid and be a strong, healthy parent and provide a healthy and completely stable environment for my child, who is to say that I'm wrong? And this is just what society is saying. So I think it's just like this huge misconception, and I think it's a power thing, and I think some people are just afraid. So, yeah.